Good afternoon. This is a presentation by PDX 911 Truth Alliance. We're a Portland group that doesn't believe the 9/11 Commission report presents a true picture of what happened on 9/11. The recent Zogby poll, you may have seen, it's not widely reported, but it revealed that and this was put out May 22nd, so it's very recent, it revealed that over 70 million voting age Americans distrust the official 9/11 story and support a new investigation of possible U.S. government role in the attacks. So then the question might be, well, why do we support a new investigation of what really happened on 9/11? Well, we believe that this official 9/11 report does not answer many of the original questions that were raised by family members of the victims who died on 9/11. We believe that the government has unnecessarily classified much of the forensic and photographic evidence that would answer many, if not most, of the unanswered questions. Now, what are some of the unanswered questions? There's a list of 26 of them on the Global Outlook Canadian website. There is a list of 40 questions on the 911truth.org website. There is a list of 200 questions on called the Smoking Guns on the 911review.org. Questions. So there are a multitude of questions that have not been answered. What do we hope to accomplish today? We hope that our presentation will provide new information about the unanswered questions related to 9/11. We hope this new information will lead members of the audience to read some of the books, watch some of the DVDs that address these unanswered questions about 9/11. Now, a note of caution. Some of the theories that are presented in the various books and on the DVDs may be proven wrong because we don't have the information that would prove it one way or the other. There is disagreement among many investigative reporters about what actually happened on 9/11 and who was behind it all. However, we believe that many of these unanswered questions can be answered if the government releases the unnecessarily classified information. So what are we going to show today? Our presentation will include selections from various DVDs and 9/11 information. We'll start out with a selection from The Great Conspiracy, which will show the proposed Northwoods military plan from, I think it was 1962, and also it will discuss the 9/11 air defense stand-down, which occurred on September 11th. The fact that with this $1 trillion air defense system that we have spent billions of dollars year after year did not work against 19 guys with box guns. You figure that one out. The next segment will be about the Pentagon. It's again, the Pentagon is a very controversial segment because of the unreleased information that the government does have. What actually happened. Then we'll show the World Trade Centers. Most people are unaware that World Trade Center 7, not 1 and 2, but World Trade Center 7 was brought down. was pulled down, although it had not been hit by any airplane. And just last week, we got a picture in the paper that World Trade Center 7, that had been completely demolished, has now been rebuilt. There is a new World Trade Center 7 in New York. They, of course, haven't rebuilt 1 and 2. Then we'll show, again, a controversial section on Flight 93, the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. Now, some of you may have seen the new Flight 93 movie that's out, but there are a lot of questions that are not answered by that movie, and it's really, the people that are most knowledgeable about it believe that it's more or less complete mythology. Then we'll display some of the oddities, that the DVD will show some of the oddities, such as the bullet command for this World Trade Center 7, the unusual stock market transactions just prior to 9/11, and also the question of $1 billion missing gold that was in the basement of the World Trade Centers. And finally, the DVD talks about who benefits. There are people, organizations that did benefit from the collapse of the World Trade Center. And if time permits, we will also show a lot of other stuff. Right, Jenny?
Right.
So Jenny's going to do the presentation on the... And we're starting off with a great experience.
We'll try to turn the lights down a bit. Well, we can get
Hello, I'm Barry Zwicker, journalist and media critic. Welcome to The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. On this program, we ask questions the 9/11 Commission and the media never ask. We introduce experts you've never seen before and provide background you never get. We recommend books, magazines, videos, and DVDs you've probably never heard of, and websites the media keep under wraps. We avoid thought stoppers, such as anti-American and conspiracy theorists, and that new word believed to be linked to Al-Qaeda. U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt declared, "The greatest thing we have to fear is fear itself." And indeed, fear may well be the greatest single human motivator. It can serve us, and it can save us, but ill-founded fear, that's another story. For instance, before we commit to a war based on a threat we're told to fear, before we commit our children's blood and billions of dollars to that war, we'd better be sure the threat is real, that a clear and present danger exists, because war itself is to be feared. U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt fought fear. Today's leaders traffic in it, chiefly the fear of terrorism. That's it. Not global warming, not the end of oil, not domestic and worldwide injustice, not rampant militarism, not war itself, or even war without end. Just terrorism. The words are hypnotically repeated. Terrorism, terrorists, terrorist threat, and of course, believed to be linked to Al-Qaeda. These words appear in millions of newspaper and magazine headlines and are embedded by the billions in stories. But it's the so-called war on terrorism that's in our faces practically 24/7 as the inescapable focus of our existence and the justification for great sacrifice.
One day, our grandchildren will look back on this time and ask, how was the war on terror won? And we will tell them about the brave men and women who gave their lives so that we could live in freedom.
Some would have it that our support for this new quasi-religion, the so-called war on terrorism, is the measure of our commitment to country and civilization. This program explores interwoven fictions that make up the fabric of the so-called war on terrorism. It explores the promiscuous issuing of terror alerts, It explores the biggest secret and dirtiest deception of all, bloody terrorist events carried out not by foreign, but by our governments, to trick the public into supporting war and police state agendas. We explore in particular the radioactive core of today's terrorist hysteria, namely the official story of 9/11, the overarching fiction and crime and cover-up of our time. Before you see this program, or after you do, there may well be another state-sponsored dirty deception. If there is, and if the information in this program helps you to see it for what it is, it will have been worthwhile. The sacred text at the heart of the so-called war on terrorism is the official narrative of what happened on September 11th, 2001, namely that the whole of U.S. intelligence, civil aviation, military, and political apparatus is caught completely off guard by one evil man and his small network of co-conspirators.
America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world. And no one will keep that light from shining.
That provides ready-made, easy-to-hate villains and their motives. They hate our freedoms, George Bush repeats over and over. But the official story just doesn't make sense, as we will show. It's exploited as planned by its creators, the government. But final responsibility for the unbelievable story living on to the extent it does in the public mind lies with the vast majority of my colleagues in the mainstream media. If they ever start to do their job properly and examine it skeptically, the official story will crumble into dust finer than that of the Twin Towers. Now, absolutely no one disagrees that 9/11 was a conspiracy. Conspiracy is at the heart of the official story, after all. A conspiracy perpetrated, allegedly, by Osama bin Laden. But what if the conspiracy were hatched not in a cave in Afghanistan, but in Washington, D.C., at the highest levels of the U.S. government? What if the public found out the official story is a big lie? How might that change plans for endless war? There are other paths to true security and lasting peace. The first step on those paths is to expose the official 9/11 story for what it is, a contrived fiction, and then to demand a true accounting of what happened on 9/11 and who was behind the events of that day. Terrorism has been with us for a long time. It tends to be the last resort of the powerless, suffering under acute injustice. And as such, one person's terrorist is seen by another as a freedom fighter. This is what Noam Chomsky calls retail terrorism, that carried out by angry or paid individuals. But then there's wholesale terrorism, that carried out by states. Robert Jensen writes in the Houston Chronicle, "For more than five decades throughout the Third World, the United States has deliberately targeted civilians or engaged in violence so indiscriminate that there is no other way to understand it except as terrorism. And it has supported similar acts of terrorism by client states." He could have reached back further. In his new book, The American Empire and the Fourth World, Anthony J. Hall, according to one reviewer, connects the unspeakable crimes visited upon indigenous people since the conquest by Columbus in 1492 to today's so-called war on terror. According to Hall himself, the imagery of terrorism has replaced that of savagery and then communism as the main explanatory catch-all to describe the real, illusory, or manufactured enemies of the American way of life. So, on one side, ours, the use of terror either is not admitted or is simply defined as not terror. And the other side's terror is defined as the only kind of terror. Terror then needs to be put into perspective. Perspective, writes Lawrence Martin, former Washington correspondent for the Globe and Mail, is a ghost in American journalism. Last year, acts of terrorism killed 300 to 400 people, ranking it so far down the list of dangers that it is barely visible. Yeah. He might have added that 300 is the number of Americans struck by lightning each year. Another note about appearance and reality. The vast majority of people arrested as terrorism suspects are released without charges being laid. It's the arrest stories with those Arab names and pictures that remain in the public mind as reality. Isn't there a pattern of state-sponsored, media-abetted deception here? But the dirtiest secret about terrorism is also by far the largest. Many spectacular acts of terrorism are fearsome fakeries carried out by cabals within governments, and I mean our own governments. The gold standard is the attack on one's own country to mobilize public opinion for power, political gain, and profit. The Nazis masterminded the torching of the Reichstag, the German parliament buildings, on February the 27th, 1933, 1 week before a national election. That they did so is historical fact, portrayed best in William L. Shirer's masterpiece, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Within hours, Hitler and his henchmen designate the communists as the villains and label them terrorists. The government promises proof, but never provides it. The communists did not do it. A single communist was the patsy. The big lie of who torched the Reichstag is used by Hitler to sow fear. He bullies the German president to sign a decree suspending 7 main articles of the German Constitution. The claim is that the fatherland, think homeland, is under threat. Ensuing arrests and murders of communists and socialists terrorize anti-Hitler dissent. In the ensuing election, Hitler does not get the majority he needs to rule. But soon after, he essentially seizes power. He then is free to launch preemptive strikes against other countries and wage a world war sold as patriotic. The ultimate result for Germans is calamitous. 600,000 civilians dead, 7.5 million homeless, their country broke and in ruins. The Reichstag fire was a major turning point. Within hours of the planes crashing into the World Trade Center, the Bush White House designates the alleged villains. Within 30 days, the U.S. Constitution and the civil liberties of Americans are weakened by near unanimous passage of the Patriot Act. A war on terror is announced. Within months, preemptive strikes are launched against Afghanistan and Iraq, though no evidence is produced that Iraq took part in 9/11. Dissent in the USA is under fire, even as millions in the USA and worldwide oppose the Iraq war. The White House announces that the war on terror, in effect world war, may never end. At least 1,000 Americans are soon to die in Iraq alone. Expenditures mount into the trillions. The so-called war on terrorism justifies the mounting deaths of U.S. soldiers and civilians in Iraq and elsewhere, justifies the little publicized construction of giant new U.S. military bases overseas, and is the basis for the doctrine of preemptive war, contrary to international law and basic morality. It's responsible for grotesquely ballooning deficits to pay for all this, debts being passed on to coming generations, and plans for even more expenditures on terror-fighting bureaucracies. The so-called war on terror is cited as the ultimate basis for sharp increases in domestic spying and reduction in freedoms and civil liberties at home and attempts to criminalize dissent. All this because the official authorized truth is that foreign terrorists attacked the USA on 9/11. As we take this in the summer of 2004, fear grows as authorities and pundits predict more terrorist events. On the scale of 9/11, or greater, the I word, inevitable, is increasingly used. The designated scapegoats of 9/11 gain nothing positive from it. On the other hand, even the hardliners in Washington themselves agree 9/11 boosted their agenda. Who benefits from more of the same? The fear campaign, always resting on the official 9/11 story, looks deliberate. Again, what if the official story of 9/11 is a big lie? You probably don't know, trapped inside the cocoon spun by the North American media industry, that there is, in fact, widespread skepticism about who was behind 9/11. 30% of Germans, according to reliable polls, think the U.S. government had a hand in it. They remember that big Reichstag deception. This poll done in Canada in May 2004 showed 63% of Canadians think individuals within the U.S. government, including the White House, had prior knowledge of the plans for the events of September 11th and failed to take appropriate action to stop them. In this program, we present some of the accumulating evidence indicating that lying behind the great deception of 9/11 is the great conspiracy of 9/11. But first, more historical context. When we come back, three true stories of fake attacks on America.
Let's find out what despotism. This man makes it his job to study these things.
Tell me when it looks.
Well, for one thing, avoid the comfortable idea that the mere form of government can of itself safeguard a nation against despotism.
Perfect.
Is that better?
Welcome back to The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. If 9/11 is a big lie, a fake attack, an inside job, is it unique? No, quite the reverse. Most war-triggering incidents are great deceptions. The Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, the attack on Pearl Harbor, all involved secretly contrived attacks on Americans planned or encouraged by American presidents. The Vietnam War and Desert Storm in 1991 also were triggered by deceptions involving U.S. presidents. If 9/11 is not such a deception, it's an exception to the rule. Most people want peace most of the time. That's a problem for rulers bent on war. History teaches that rulers arranging for their country to be attacked, or appear to be attacked, is the fastest method for these rulers to get their way when they want war. Consider only three cases, starting with this book, Body of Secrets. Author James Bamford is a former Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. I learned of this book on ABC's website. Bamford's information comes from interviews with, for instance, the former dean of the U.S. intelligence community, and from government documents. It takes 80 pages to list Bamford's more than 600 information sources. Here's the story. It's 1962. John F. Kennedy is U.S. president, Robert McNamara is Secretary of Defense, and Admiral Lyman Lemnitzer heads the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. The CIA fails in its illegal Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. JFK decides, Bamford writes, to back away from military solutions to the Cuban problem. But Lemnitzer, the CIA, and others at the top remain obsessed with Cuba. Writes Bamford, as the Kennedy brothers appeared to suddenly go soft on Cuba, Lemnitzer could see his opportunity to invade quickly slipping away. Attempts to provoke the Cuban public to revolt seemed dead. Lemnitzer and the other chiefs knew there was only one option left that would ensure their war. They would have to trick the American public and world opinion. Lemnitzer comes up with Operation Northwoods. We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. Casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation. We could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington. An elaborate variation. Create an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft. At a designated time, the duplicate would be loaded with selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted to a drone, a remotely controlled unmanned aircraft. The destruction of that aircraft will be triggered by radio signal. The Cubans would be blamed. Finally, another variation is described by Bamford. On February the 20th, 1962, John Glenn was to lift off from Cape Canaveral on his historic journey. Lemnitzer proposed that should the rocket explode and kill Glenn, the objective is to provide irrevocable proof that the fault lies with Cuba, by manufacturing various pieces of evidence which would prove electronic interference on the part of the Cubans. Thus, Bamford notes, as NASA prepared to send the first American into space, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were preparing to use John Glenn's possible death as a pretext to launch a war. The Operation Northwoods plan shows the Pentagon was capable, according to Bamford, of launching a secret and bloody war of terrorism against their own country in order to trick the American public into supporting a war on Cuba. In light of this, does Pentagon complicity in the events of September 11 sound entirely far-fetched? Now, fast forward just 2 years from Operation Northwoods to August 2, 1964. In the Gulf of Tonkin, North Vietnamese torpedo boats attacked the U.S. destroyer Maddox. The Associated Press story, for some reason, is dateline Pearl Harbor. The lead: three PT boats, identified by Secretary of State Dean Rusk as North Vietnamese, attacked. Later, a second U.S. destroyer is attacked, according to news reports. Although no U.S. sailor suffers a scratch, the American public is outraged. President Lyndon Johnson goes on television to ask the country to support war action. 2 days later, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution is approved by the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously, then by the Senate 88-2. The resolution becomes the entire justification for the United States war against Vietnam. Before that's over, 58,000 American soldiers and 3 million Vietnamese die. One small problem: there never were any North Vietnamese PT boats. The events never happened. As Secretary of State Rusk, the President, and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara well know. They know because they planned the entire deception. One source for this is former Admiral James Stockdale in his book, In Love and War. On the night in question, Stockdale is at the controls of a fighter jet flying cover for the two destroyers. He sees nothing. Another source is Ben Bradley, much respected former managing editor of the Washington Post. Bradley, in a public lecture in England in April 1987, states, "The facts behind this critically important resolution were quite simply lies." Fast forward again to August 2, 1990. Iraq attacks Kuwait, claiming the Kuwaitis are slant drilling into Iraq's oil fields. U.S. President George Herbert Walker Bush pushes for a land war against Iraq, but polls show the U.S. public is split 50-50 on that idea. Then comes this eyewitness testimony before a congressional committee from a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl. The claim is she cannot be identified for fear of reprisals.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come to the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
The U.S. public is outraged. The result? Support for land war zooms. It's a turning point. Desert Storm is launched. 135,000 Iraqis are killed. An estimated 1 million Iraqis, many of them children and old people, then die as a result of 10 years of sanctions. One small problem: there never were any incubator baby deaths, not one. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's investigative flagship program, The Fifth Estate, reveals the girl to be the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, given her lines and coached in acting by the giant American PR firm Hill & Knowlton. It's one phase in a $10 million joint U.S.-Kuwaiti campaign of deception. This man is lying.
I myself buried 40 newborn babies that had been taken from their incubators.
This man is lying.
They had kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
There were a lot of people who participated in a conspiracy. Yes, an out-and-out conspiracy of fake organizations, false documents, fraud, and disinformation. So, if a new man named Bush is in the White House and helps engineer a brazen deception in order to achieve global geopolitical goals as well as domestic and personal ones, it wouldn't be a first, would it? After a short break, a detailed look at the events of September 11, 2001.
Today, democracy can ebb away in communities whose citizens allow power to become concentrated in the hands of bosses.
When I say go, see? I'm the law around here.
The test of despotic power is that it can disregard the will of the people.
Welcome back to the Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. The events of 9/11 begin with aircraft going wildly off course.
Okay, so can they do false flag plan and carry out that false flag operations against civilians in our country?
Yes,
we know that. So, what's next on our list?
It's on that list there, from loose
like
change to
see. So,
it'll be the one on the Pentagon.
Is this your?
And for anyone not,
this is loose change to.
Are we going to be able to get a copy of this or buy a copy of this?
Weicker? Yeah, you can.
I can give you.
We actually have it. This is the Jeff Love compilation for them.
No, I don't think it is. Is it?
It doesn't look.
Is that Jeff Love's compilation?
No, it's.
I don't want six people that could not be here.
Yeah, I know.
Would you promise to show it to them?
Oh, well, one is my wife. Yes, absolutely. Okay. The other four I work with.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm willing to compensate for it. I mean, it's this. What?
Here's what you can do.
I have to cool down first, please. This is kind of stuff that really upsets me.
Man, it's upsets a lot of people. Yeah.
Well, I mean that our news media is purchased and bought, and I'm so sick of the pretty news that we get. It's wake up to.
It's disgusting.
Don't get me started.
Okay. So I hope I haven't checked all of these to see if there's that, and it's very good. The whole thing is good. There's some other resources out here.
Some
audio
speaking. No, I don't think it was. No.
Well,
yeah, in fact, it was.
Do whatever you want. It's there. The point is to get the word out. So take that, spread the word, use it as much as you can.
No problem. Yeah, I mean, I'm staying. I'm not leaving.
Okay.
I'll stretch my legs and you can stand up.
Okay, do you want to start?
No, from at the Pentagon. It's got segments that you can go through, right?
I'm skipping ahead.
Can you go to the particular segments?
Well, I'm doing it now. Can you tell me which one is which?
Well, there's one labeled. You made the you wrote down the starting captain. Yeah, there you go. So it'll be the Pentagon. Yeah, now you know.
So you don't want to start here?
No, Pentagon.
Okay. Here we go.
Hi.
We can discuss that later.
Okay. I'm thinking. We'll just make sure to see it.
There's a controversy within the group as to how hard we should push the issue of the Pentagon, because the evidence is so confusing. The other evidence is much more clear.
938.
So,
Arlington.
Yeah, there is something funny about the Pentagon, but it's hard to prove.
Hang on,
there's
actually a speed of 330 degree turn at 530 miles per hour.
That's.
Descending 7,000 feet in 2.5 minutes to crash American Airlines Flight 77 into the ground floor of the Pentagon.
This is impossible. Yeah.
Its final approach took it directly across Interstate 395. Pulls out of the ground and bouncing off the lawn before impact. First, let's meet Hani Hanyor. Hanyor had come to Freeway Airport in Bowie, Maryland 1 month earlier seeking to rent a small plane. However, when Hanyor went on 3 test runs in the second week of August, He had trouble controlling and landing a single-engine Cessna 172.
My name is Marcel Bernard, and I'm the chief flight instructor here at Freeway. On the Honduras, well, basically what happened with him is he showed up at the airport and wanted to get checked out of the aircraft. See, he was already certified. He didn't come to us for flight training.
Yeah, he already had a pilot's license.
He had already earned his private instrument commercial at a school in Arizona. I don't remember the name of the school, but already had certificates in hand. And, we sometimes, occasionally have pilots that come to us that don't want flight training, but just want to rent our aircraft.
Which is the case of Pawnee Highlands.
This is the case of Pawnee. He wanted to get checked out, as we call it, to rent our aircraft. And our insurance requires him to fly one of our instructors to be found competent to rent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the process that he was going through. So the census was he was very quiet, average or below average piloting skills.
Mm-hmm.
English was very poor. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether that's about the best description I can give. Give you his demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
It's very uneventful from my perspective.
Regardless, air traffic controllers at Dulles International Airport that were tracking Flight 77 all thought that it was a military plane. Second, the light poles. On November 22, 2004, a private jet en route to Houston to pick up George Bush Sr. clipped a single light pole and crashed a minute away from landing at Houston's hobby airport. The wing ripped off upon impact, scattering debris over 100 yards. And yet, Flight 77 managed to tear five light poles completely out of the ground without damaging either the wings or the light poles themselves. Instead, they seem to have just popped out of the ground. Third, you only have to look at the photos from that day to realize that whatever hit the Pentagon did not bounce off the lawn. If Flight 77 had crash-landed and skidded into the Pentagon, it would have looked like this. Instead, it looked like this, without a single scratch on the lawn. Fourth, why is there absolutely no trace of Flight 77?
You know, it might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual site of the building that's crashed in, and as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around, which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon.
The official explanation is that the intense heat from the jet fuel vaporized the entire plane. Indeed, from these pictures, it seems that there is absolutely no trace of a Boeing 757. But if the fire was hot enough to incinerate a jumbo jet, then how can investigators identify 184 out of 189 people found at the Pentagon? The Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory, which was responsible for the task, was also responsible for identifying the dead in Shanksville. Keep that in mind for later. So what is a Boeing 757 made of? I called Boeing to ask, but the operator informed me that Boeing refuses to give out any information regarding the construction of their aircraft due to the attacks of September 11. But what we do know is that a 757 has two Pratt & Whitney engines made of steel and titanium alloy, which are 9 feet in diameter, 12 feet long, and weigh 6 tons each. Titanium has a melting point of 1,688 degrees Celsius. Jet fuel, also known as kerosene, is a hydrocarbon, which can retain a constant temperature of 1,120 degrees Celsius after 40 minutes, but only if the fuel is maintained. The fuel would have burned off immediately upon impact. Therefore, it is scientifically impossible that 12 tons of steel and titanium was vaporized by kerosene. Likewise, the two engines should have been found relatively intact at the Pentagon. Instead, there was a single turbojet engine, approximately 3 feet in diameter, found inside the building. After this photo was published by American Free Press, readers wrote in to suggest that the turbine was a piece from the auxiliary power unit, APU, mounted in the tail section of the 757. Chris Bolin contacted Honeywell in Phoenix, Arizona, the manufacturer of the 757's APU. An expert, speaking on the condition of anonymity, told him that there's no way that that's an APU wheel. Bolin then contacted Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce, the two companies that manufacture 757 engines. Pratt & Whitney pointed Bolin towards Rolls-Royce, and John W. Brown, a spokesman for Rolls-Royce, told Bolin that it is not a part from any Rolls-Royce engine that I'm familiar with. In an article written by Carl Schwartz, President and Chief Executive Officer of Patmos Nanotechnologies, LLC, and iNet Security Systems, he believes that the piece is a JT-8D turbojet engine from a U.S. Air Force A-3 Sky Warrior. The piece in the FEMA photo is the front shaft bearing housing. Jet engines have a center shaft, which must be balanced, as well as bear seals on the front and back. The photo shows the front seal and a rotor hub missing its fan blades. These blades are easily removed in a collision such as the one found at the Pentagon. The United States Air Force has only a few A-3s left in operation, and they are stored in Van Nuys, California, at Hughes Aircraft, which is now better known as Raytheon. So if this piece didn't come from a 757, then where? And where are the engines from Flight 77? The second identifiable piece of debris was allegedly a piece of the fuselage. Skeptics have claimed that this is proof that Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. But this piece could have come from any American Airlines plane. And why is it not singed or scratched after a 530-mile-per-hour impact and a subsequent fireball? The third piece of debris was a diffuser case. Let's look a little closer at the diffuser case of the 757. Do you see the triangular bezels around the openings? Those are nowhere to be found on the case found at the Pentagon. The remainder of the debris was light enough to have been carried by hand, and employees at the Pentagon were seen carrying away a large box shrouded in a blue tarp. Why the mystery? If Flight 77 was vaporized on impact, it would be the first time in aviation history. For example, August 15, 2005, Helios Airways Flight 522, a Boeing 737 en route to Athens, Greece, crashed into a hillside at full speed. 121 passengers, all dead. Fire. Tail sections. Wing sections. Engines. Cockpit. Bodies. Catch my drift? Fifth, why is the damage to the Pentagon completely inconsistent with the Boeing 757? These photos were taken before the roof of the outer ring collapsed. The only damage to the outer wall is a single hole, no more than 16 feet in diameter. A Boeing 757 is 155 feet long, 44 feet high, has a 124-foot wingspan, and weighs almost 100 tons. Are we supposed to believe that it disappeared into this hole without there being any wreckage on the outside? Why is there no damage from where the wings, or the vertical stabilizer, or the engines would have slammed into the building? Remember how big the engines were? If 6 tons of steel and titanium slammed into the Pentagon at 530 miles per hour, they would bury themselves inside the building, leaving two very distinct imprints. And yet, the only damage on the outside of the Pentagon was this single hole, with no damage from where the engines would have hit. Why are the windows next to the hole completely intact? Why are the cable spools directly in front of the hole completely untouched? And as for the inside of the Pentagon, there's another hole, approximately 16 feet in diameter, found on the other side of the C-ring, 3 rings from the impact. For that hole to have been caused by Flight 77, the Boeing would have had to smash through 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete. The nose of a commercial airliner is composed of lightweight carbon. This is what usually happens to the nose of a commercial airliner in a plane crash. If the nose caused this hole, where's the rest of the debris from the plane? So what could blow a 16-foot hole in the outer ring of the Pentagon, smash through 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete, and leave another 16-foot hole? A cruise missile. This is what Slobodan Milosevic's residence in Belgrade looked like after a Tomahawk cruise missile hit it. See any similarities?
Sixth, the eyewitnesses. Some saw a huge 100-ton commercial airliner.
And I looked off, looked out my window. I saw this plane, a jet, American Airlines jet, coming.
Some saw a small 8 to 20 passenger commuter plane.
So it looked to be maybe a 20 passenger corporate jet, no markings on the side, coming in at a shallow.
And some saw a United States military helicopter.
He said that he saw a helicopter circle the building. He said that it appeared to be a U.S. military helicopter, and that it disappeared behind the building where the helicopter landing zone is, and that he then saw a fireball go into the sky.
So who's telling the truth? Take this into consideration. April Gallup was working in the Pentagon's west side when it was hit. In Jim Marsh's book, Inside Job, April claims, while in the hospital, men in suits visited her more than once. They never identified themselves or what agency they worked for. They didn't tell her what to say, just made suggestions. For example, to take the compensation money and shut up. They also kept insisting that a plane hit the building. They repeated this over and over. But I was there, and I never saw a plane, or even debris from a plane. I figured this story is to brainwash people. So if a Boeing 757 didn't hit the Pentagon, then what did? Eyewitnesses inside and outside the building were thrown to the ground by what they described as a shockwave. Even the Sheraton Hotel, 1.6 miles away, was rocked by the blast. A number of military personnel at the Pentagon specifically mentioned smelling cordite. Cordite and jet fuel have two very distinct smells. Cordite is a compound used in ammunition, which is comprised of nitroguanidine, nitrocellulose, and nitroglycerin. It is cool burning, produces little smoke and no flash, but produces a strong detonation wave. And eyewitnesses described a bright, silvery flash. Jet fuel combustion, i.e., the planes that struck the Twin Towers, is bright yellow at best. Watch this. A massive smoldering fireball. No silvery flash, no shockwave. And at the Pentagon, a tiny, bright, silvery flash, which shakes nearby buildings. Whatever it was, it might have been related to the two planes that were in the air after the crash. The first one was uniformly identified as a C-130. The second plane was an unmarked white plane flying over Washington, D.C.
Aaron, I'm standing in Lafayette Park directly across from the White House, perhaps about 200 yards from the White House residence itself. About 10 minutes ago, there was a white jet circling overhead. Now, you generally don't see planes in the area over the White House. That is restricted airspace. No reason to believe that this jet was there for any nefarious purposes, but the Secret Service was very concerned, pointing up at the jet in the sky. It is out of sight now, best we can tell.
At 9:25, Jane Garvey, the head of the FAA, initiated a national ground stop, which prevents further takeoffs and requires all planes in the air to land. The order, which hasn't been implemented since 1903, applied to almost every single kind of plane, civilian, military, or law enforcement. Certain military flights were allowed to fly during this time, but the FAA isn't talking. Why were these two planes allowed in the air when everyone else had to land? And finally, why did people keep reporting a second explosion at the Pentagon?
Well, I can't tell you about that, but I was just here in front of the Capitol, which, by the way, has been evacuated, and back toward the Supreme Court area, we just heard a low, muffled thud. It sounded like a small explosion.
There have been unconfirmed reports of second explosions here at the Pentagon. We have not confirmed that, but again, the counterintelligence sources...
where did this fall? Did Flight 77 hit the Pentagon? All we have to do is we're above those cases. Instead, they were...
I think we've moved into the World Trade Center section.
959, New York City, New York. The south tower of the World Trade Center collapsed to the ground.
Now, that Pentagon thing is controversial, as I mentioned, among the various investigative reporters, but you can see that there are outstanding questions that haven't been answered that the government could answer if they'd release those papers. So that's why I feel that the Pentagon is an important thing to consider as far as unanswered questions.
It's a good thing to think about. Does that help?
Turn it off.
Turn it off. Okay. Well, I just wanted to know from Glenn if the recorder is going and if... Okay, it's over there. Great. The thing I would just add on the Pentagon issue is that there are people who live in Washington who saw the plane go into the Pentagon. So what many in the movement believe is that the frames that were released and a lot of the controversy that's been stirred up is in itself another false flag, sort of an operation, a psyops on all of us. To make us bicker, to make us divided. But I think that Ray has pointed out the really important thing, and that is the cover-up. Why don't they just give us the videos? Why have they created this cover-up? And if we focus on that sort of thing, I think it's a good avenue. When you look at all the Pentagon questions, you go, well, go ahead and release that video from across the street. That would solve it. Then we don't have to debate.
But again, a counter-argument to that, the questions that were brought up in that video have not been answered yet.
Well, I actually disagree. Well, there's a very good answer to many of those questions at a website called www.911research.com. Have you checked into that? That's
I've seen that thing,
yeah.
But I'm not convinced.
Okay.
Yet.
Well, just since you brought it up, the point is that the Pentagon had been highly reinforced, super strong reinforcement. So the plane going into the walls would fall apart because of the strength of the, you know, this is the iron. All that work was being done, so that side of the Pentagon was empty. Don Rumsfeld's office was way on the other side. So the plane came in, and apparently it didn't just hit into the Pentagon, it did a way through 280 turn, it came around so that conveniently could hit the side that was not inhabited and had been reinforced for weeks and it was away from Don Rumsfeld's office. So that kind of information about the Pentagon, we should look into. It's too bad that they didn't, I don't know if they focused on that or brought it up even, but that website, 911research.com, is absolutely wonderful. It's got very solid information on this question. So the next thing we're going to do is look at the buildings.
The next section from the Loose Change 2 DVD is the World Trade Center. Yeah, it'll bring out the World Trade Center 7 that the press has not covered at all, and then it goes into detail of World Trade Centers 1 and 2, which now look as though
it can only be
brought down by controlled demolition. Mm.
Is there a question?
No, I only waved to my friend.
Okay. Hi.
I never waved back.
Approximately 10 seconds. 29 minutes later, the North Tower follows suit, collapsing in approximately 10 seconds. Later that evening at 5:20, World Trade Center 7, a 47-story office building 300 feet away from the North Tower, suddenly collapses. The building's tenants included the CIA, Department of Defense, IRS, Secret Service, and Rudy Giuliani's emergency bunker. And the SEC was using it to store 3,000 to 4,000 files related to numerous Wall Street investigations. Although every single building surrounding Building 7 stood intact, it fell straight down into a convenient little pile in 6 seconds. Official explanation? Falling debris from the Twin Towers created an internal fire, which ignited several fuel tanks inside the building. If this is true, then it would be the third building in history to collapse because of a fire. The first two would be the Twin Towers. On July 28, 1945, a B-52 bomber lost in the fog crashed into the 79th floor of the Empire State Building. 14 people dead, $1 million in damage, but the building stands intact to this day. On February 14, 1975, a three-alarm fire broke out between the 9th and 14th floors of the North Tower. According to the New York Times, the fire leads to intense scrutiny of the towers and eventually to a decision to install sprinklers. On May 4, 1988, a 62-story skyscraper in Los Angeles burned for 3 hours and spread over 4 floors. It did not collapse. On February 23, 1991, a 38-story skyscraper in Philadelphia, built in 1973, burned for more than 19 hours and spread over 8 floors. It did not collapse. On October 17, 2004, a 56-story skyscraper in Venezuela, built in 1976, burned for over 17 hours and spread over 26 floors, eventually reaching the roof. Guess what? It did not collapse. On February 12, 2005, the Windsor Building in Madrid, a 32-story tower framed in steel-reinforced concrete, burned for almost 24 hours, completely eradicating the upper 10 stories of the building. Although the top 10 floors of the building fell, the building itself did not collapse. And yet, on September 11, 2001, two 110-story skyscrapers, completed in 1973, burned for 56 and 103 minutes, respectively, over 4 floors, before collapsing completely to the ground. One might argue that this was due to the construction of the World Trade Center. Let's look at what was inside those buildings. The Twin Towers were composed of 200,000 tons of steel, 425,000 cubic yards of concrete, 103 elevators, 43,600 windows, 60,000 tons of cooling equipment, and a 360-foot television antenna. The core of each tower was 87 by 133 feet, comprised of 47 box columns 36 by 16 inches thick. The North Tower was completed in 1973, clocking in at 1,362 feet tall, making them the tallest buildings in the world until the Sears Tower was completed in 1974. And to think, the government would have us believe that these massive structures were destroyed by 10,000 gallons of jet fuel. However, eyewitnesses, video footage, and a little common sense quickly refutes that claim. The second plane hits the South Tower between the 78th and 82nd floors at 9:03 a.m. Southeast corner, the majority of the jet fuel exploding outside the massive fireball. Yet, this tower collapses first, even though the North Tower was hit straight on and had already been burning for 18 minutes longer. Galileo's law of falling bodies calculates the time in which an object will travel a certain distance in complete freefall. Distance, d, equals 16.8 times time in seconds squared. The South Tower was 1,362 feet tall. 1362 equals 16.08 times 84.7, or 9.2 seconds. The Twin Towers came down in nearly free fall speed. 200,000 tons of steel shatters into sections no longer than a couple feet long. 425,000 cubic yards of concrete is pulverized into dust. Thousands of lives are extinguished instantly. So what brought down the World Trade Center? Let's ask the experts. Vin Romero, Vice President for Research at New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, My opinion is, based on the videotapes, after the airplanes hit the World Trade Center, there were some explosive devices inside that caused the towers to collapse. The collapses were too methodical to be a chance result of airplanes colliding with the structures. 10 days later, certainly the fire is what caused the building to fail. Why would Romero change his mind so suddenly? Hyman Brown, civil engineering professor and the World Trade Center's construction manager. It was over-designed to withstand almost anything, including hurricanes, high winds, bombings, and an airplane hitting it. Although the buildings were designed to withstand a 150-year storm and the impact of a Boeing 707, jet fuel burning at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit weakened the steel. Kevin Ryan, Underwriters Laboratories, the company that certified the steel that was used in the World Trade Center, in a letter to Frank Gale of the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We know that the steel components were certified to ASTM E119. The time temperature curves for this standard require the samples to be exposed to temperatures around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for several hours, and as we all agree, the steel applied met those specifications. Additionally, I think we can all agree that even unfireproof steel will not melt until reaching red-hot temperatures of nearly 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Why Dr. Brown would imply that 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit would melt the high-grade steel used in those buildings makes no sense at all. This story just does not add up. If steel from those buildings did soften or melt, I'm sure we can all agree that this was certainly not due to jet fuel fires of any kind, let alone the briefly burning fires in those towers. Ryan's statements directly contradict statements from so-called experts, which claim that 2,000-degree heat inside the World Trade Center caused the towers to collapse. Days after writing this letter, Kevin Ryan was fired from his position. Not even the experts agree with each other. So what else could have caused the Twin Towers and Building 7 to collapse?
10 o'clock Eastern Time this morning, just collapsing on itself.
The second building that was hit by the plane has just completely collapsed.
We have no idea what caused this.
Almost looks like one of those planned implosions.
And then the demolition team set off. When you see the old demolition, the old building, it blew it down by itself and it is not there anymore.
If you wish to bring on anybody who's ever watched a building being demolished on purpose knows that if you're going to do this, you have to get at the under infrastructure of a building and bring it down.
We heard another explosion, and I'm assuming that's the one that came from the lower level, since there were two. And
because it was like 18 minutes apart.
Well, this is the first explosion, and there was a second explosion in the same building. There were two explosions.
Okay. Federal agencies that were down there do believe that there was some sort of explosive device somewhere else besides the planes hitting.
The museum Pat Dawson is close to the scene of that attack.
Just moments ago, I spoke to the Chief of Safety for the New York City Fire Department, Chief Albert Turry. He received word of the possibility of a secondary device, that is another bomb going off. He tried to get his men out as quickly as he could, but he said that there was another explosion which took place. And then an hour after the first hit here, or the first crash that took place, he said, there was another explosion that took place in one of the towers here. He thinks that there were actually devices that were planted in the building. The second device, he thinks, he speculates, was probably planted in the building.
There were two or three similar huge explosions, and the building literally shook. You literally shook at the base of this building.
First one and then the other. Some say after secondary explosions.
When a big explosion happened, all of a sudden the elevator blew up, smoke. I dragged the guy out, his skin was hanging off. And I dragged him out, and I helped him out of the ambulance.
Coming down the stairs and made it to the 8th floor. Big explosion. Who was back into the 8th floor?
He's getting in the tunnel, man.
Tell us what's happening out there.
Oh,
we just witnessed some kind of secondary follow-up explosion on the World Trade Center Tower 2, the one
secondary.
We understand now there has been a secondary explosion on Tower 2.
There was another major explosion. The building itself, literally the top of it came down, sending smoke and debris everywhere.
Collapsed 5 blocks from the World Trade Center. And we were standing here when there was some sort of collapse or explosion. Do you know if it was an explosion or if it was a building collapse? To me it sounded like an explosion.
When I tried to take people in a moment, we heard a big explosion coming down. Everything just went black. Everything came down, glass stopped parking. and people got hurt, stuff went on top of them, and it was a big explosion, and everything got dark, real dark, like snow.
The FBI is here, as you can see. They have roped this area off. They were taking photographs and securing this area just prior to that huge explosion that we all heard and felt.
Turn on my radio. Get out of the area so they can tell us what's going on. Yes, it's about to collapse.
At 10:30, I tried to leave the building, but as soon as I got outside, I heard a second explosion and another rumble and more smoke and more dust. I ran inside the building. The chandelier shook, and again, black smoke filled the air. Within another 5 minutes, we were covered again with more silt and more dust. And then a fire marshal came in and said we had to leave because if there was a third explosion, this building might not last.
We just saw that as well. The second tower, the only one that was standing, tower number one, just we saw some kind of explosion, a lot of smoke come out of the top of the tower, and then it collapsed down onto the streets below.
David Lee, what can you tell us?
John, just seconds ago there was a huge explosion, and it appears right now the second World Trade Tower has just collapsed.
One eyewitness was standing among a crowd of people on Church Street, 2.5 blocks from the South Tower, when he saw a number of brief light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. He saw about 6 of these flashes, accompanied by a crackling sound before the tower collapsed. Ginny Carr was attending a business meeting on the 36th floor of One Liberty Plaza, across the street from the World Trade Center, and caught the entire first attack on tape. A second explosion can be heard 9 seconds after the crash. So what happened in the North Tower? Ask Willie Rodriguez. Willie, a janitor who worked in the World Trade Center for 20 years, was in sublevel 1 when the North Tower was hit.
And all of a sudden, we go, boom! I thought it was a generator coming along with the basement tower. And I said to myself, oh my God, I think it's a generator. And I was going to verbalize it. When I finished saying that, in my mind, I hear, boom! Right on the top, pretty far away. So it was a difference between coming from the basement and coming from the top. And that's, everybody started screaming. And a person comes running into the office saying, explosion, explosion, explosion. He got his hand extended, and all the skin was pulled from his under his arm, all the way to the top of the fingertips, and he was hanging in both arms. Hanging and hanging. And then I look at his face, and he was missing parts of his face. And I said, what happened? What happened? And he said, the elevators, the elevators. And when there were many explosions, and when I actually talk about those explosions, they said that, well, there were so many kitchens in the building, and they have probably those gas canisters. And I said, I don't believe that, because the building was a Class A building. There are very strict guidelines of what you can put in the kitchen. And I really doubt it was gas. So there was a lot of misconceptions of what happened that day in terms of the explosion. But up to date, I haven't received an actual explanation about the different explosions that I had on the open floors and not on the way to the tower.
The windows in the lobby of the North Tower were blown out, and marble panels were blown off of the walls. This was brushed off as damage from a raging fireball that went barreling down the elevator shafts. However, the World Trade Center's core and elevator shafts were hermetically sealed, aka airtight. The fire could not possibly have had enough oxygen to travel 1,300 feet down, retaining enough energy to destroy the bottom 8 floors of the building. On 9/11, New York City lost 343 firefighters at the World Trade Center. Since they were the ones inside the towers before and as they collapsed, I'd say they've got a pretty good grasp on what happened. So what does the FDNY think? First, we had this interview from the Nade Brothers documentary.
I'd like to ask you about
We made it at least 2 blocks, and we started running. It was floor by floor, it started popping out. All the way down. I was watching it and running. Just ran up. And then you just sort of this. cloud of shit chasing you down. Could not have had a question.
In these interviews, numerous members of Engine 7 described explosions preceding the collapses, not to mention the damage to the lobby of the North Tower.
I heard a loud boom. My first day, I was right at the desk there, on the left-hand side when you come into Tower 1. And I walked out. You know, I didn't go out. I walked to where all the doorway was, the glass was broken, and I looked out. And I seen in the building across the street, I seen the shadow coming, like the, I seen the shadow in the building across the street coming down. And with that,
I was expecting to see the damage that I saw in the lobby and the people, the bodies, the burnt people, the injured people. I really wasn't prepared for that.
He was about 6:30 high, and the lobby looked as though a bomb had exploded there. All the glass was taken out. There were 10-foot by 10-foot marble panels that were once walls. They were loose from the wall of the Trade Center.
I went around by the freight elevator, and I could see it was just blown. It was just a giant 30th floor. We hear another explosion. And at that time, we heard a huge explosion.
Firefighter Louis Caccioli told People Weekly, "I was taking firefighters up in the elevator to the 24th floor to get in position to evacuate workers. On the last trip up, a bomb went off. We think there were bombs set in the building." For more than a year, the Port Authority blocked the release of a tape of firefighters' transmissions from the World Trade Center on 9/11. In November 2002, the tape was finally released to the New York Times and other news outlets. Why did it take so long to get the tape released? Chief Palmer had reached the fire on the 78th floor of the South Tower and devised a plan to put it out. If the 78th floor was a raging inferno like the government would have us believe, then Palmer wouldn't have gotten as far as he did, and certainly wouldn't have been able to put it out. On August 12, 2005, an additional 15 hours of radio transmissions and transcripts of interviews with firefighters was finally released to the public. Firefighters described two events consistent with a controlled demolition: bright flashes from inside the building, sounds before the building's collapse. What does science have to say about the collapses? The collapse of the World Trade Center was picked up by Columbia University's observatory in Palisades, New York. The South Tower registers a 2.1 earthquake. The North Tower registers a 2.3 earthquake. Won Young Kim told Chris Bolin that their seismographs pick up underground explosions from a quarry 20 miles away. These blasts are caused by 80,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate and cause local earthquakes between magnitude 1 and 2. The 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center did not even register because it was not coupled to the ground. During the collapse, most of the energy of the falling debris was absorbed by the towers and the neighboring structures, converting them into rubble and dust or causing other damage, but not causing significant ground shaking. Mark Loiseau, the president of Controlled Demolition Incorporated, told the American Free Press that in the basements of the World Trade Center, where 47 central support columns connected to the bedrock, hot spots of literally molten steel were discovered more than a month after September 11th. These incredibly hot areas were found at the bottoms of the elevator shafts, down 7 basement levels. The molten steel was found 3, 4, and 5 weeks later, when the rubble was being removed. He said that molten steel was also found at World Trade Center 7. The highest temperature was in the east corner of the South Tower, where a temperature of 1,377 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded. The molten steel in the basement was more than double that temperature. Do you still think that jet fuel brought down the World Trade Center? In all the videos of the collapses, explosions can be seen bursting from the building 20 to 30 stories below the demolition wave. Here. Here. Insurance Holdings, which insured parts of the World Trade Center on 9/11. More information on this was supposed to be disclosed and never was. To date, the SEC has not revealed what they have learned. If only we could examine the debris from the World Trade Center and figure out what happened. Unfortunately, Mayor Giuliani began shipping the remains off to recycling yards overseas before investigators could even examine it. Not even FEMA was allowed into Ground Zero. Essentially, they blocked off the crime scene and destroyed all the evidence. Guess who was allowed into the site? Controlled Demolition, who was also responsible for cleaning up after the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. It gets better than that. On July 15, 2001, Controlled Demolition destroyed 2 400-foot-tall fuel reserve tanks from the World War II era. The demolition was conducted for no apparent reason and drew numerous complaints from the neighborhood. The site remains vacant to this day, and a reason for the demolition has never been disclosed. Regardless, I think what happened at the World Trade Center is simple enough. It was brought down in a carefully planned controlled demolition. It was a psychological attack on the American people, and it was pulled off with military precision.
Okay, this now goes into Flight 93.
So,
and remember, this is a very controversial system, but if you just go and watch the new movie United 7, Flight 93, why you go away not thinking that there are tremendous questions, unanswered questions about what happened.
Why do you think we have a break now?
That's fine with me.
Yeah, and we'll come back to flight 93 because there's actually kind of a lot to say about that.
So we'll get to some of the other issues if everyone is comfortable with it. Or, anyone not seeing loose change?
Is this loose change?
This is
watching?
Loose change. I haven't seen loose admission.
I have a copy that I will watch. Yeah.
Okay. So it's new to you?
It's new to me because I have the older one. If you feel that it's something that has not been sufficiently covered in the mainstream press, I'd like to see it. But if everybody else has seen it, we can hold on to a vote. I think that your idea to proceed is after a break is good. Unless everybody's seen it, we want a vote to move on.
It's 18 minutes. Well, this is new. Parts of what's in here is new to me.
Okay.
I've never seen any of this stuff. I mean, I've had my own theories on it. I got to go back and tell my wife she was running the money the whole time. It's just as disgusting as an American citizen, as a veteran, as a Vietnam veteran. Yeah. I didn't want to believe any of this. I didn't want to believe there was a conspiracy, but I cannot ignore the facts. Facts and truth cannot be ignored. So why is the mainstream media ignoring it? And my question is, we've been duped so badly. I don't know if we can pull ourselves. That's what bothers me. I don't know that there's so many generations behind these younger kids today. There's so many of them just don't seem to give a darn about what has happened to our country.
Maybe movies like this will at least help.
Look who's here. There's not a person. There was maybe a one young man who are under 30.
Well, not that
we aren't under 30. That's what's going on?
Well, it's important to find a way to find them.
It is. It certainly is. But I mean, is it too late?
Well,
that's the question.
For what?
He has surrounded himself. He has protected the executive office and made him. Everybody, you know what's happened in the news. The way he has manipulated and violated the Constitution.
Exactly.
You can't touch the executive office anymore. There's no debate in Congress anymore. Even our senators and congressmen don't stand up, and they ought to be up there saying, "We ought to go kick his butt," but they're not.
They're part of it, is the thing. That's what I've decided.
You know, my wife and I were in D.C. last September, or a year ago, and we were there, and we were walking around, and I was like, wait a minute, you know, I was here 2 years ago, and I could come here and make a little bit. This is my country. What do you mean I can't go across the street? You know, you're telling me I can't cross the street in my own country. Why? We're going back. I'm going back in September. We went up to 9/11. We went up to Ground Zero in New York. We went up there. I stood there. I mean, it was just, you can't tell anything from any of the Europe. I mean, it's all been paved over. I mean, some of you probably did too. But I mean, I wanted to see it for myself. I wanted to say, let's go to New York. Because I'm so disappointed in our leadership. That's what I'm really disappointed
in.
I'm not afraid. I like to have my facts before I make a decision.
I would like to bring up one point that Mike Rupert brought up in the in a video called Truth and Lies about 9/11. He made it less than 2 months after the attacks, which was unbelievably right on. And what he did show was that we have had, for 38 years, photographic, this river film has shown very clearly, I won't bore you with it, shown Kennedy being hit from the front. And so all this stuff, which is wonderful, and I just really think this is a real improvement over the videos that I've seen, it doesn't necessarily mean people are going to believe us. And for 38 years they've had, the evidence is shocking and graphic that he's hit, not way back, very hard. People get, and that would mean two gunmen at least. And people, it's a funny thing. People just don't necessarily believe.
It's a big lie.
Yeah.
The media has a stranglehold. And it's essentially up to us. Everything is resting on a base of mass acquiescence. We're accepting. Oh, well, okay. We let it happen.
Yeah.
So it's just up to us. I don't have much faith in the Democratic Party. You know, I'm a Democrat. You know, I'm fighting for them to win. But I see them day after day after day just lie down. And so how are we supposed to get
up ahead of steam
and help them? We have to get through them. We just somehow. I hope those people in Eugene this weekend are doing something to get through. In Eugene is the Democratic Party convention going on for the state of Oregon. Howard Dean came to town.
I just wanted to say that it's hard to get the 9/11 information out to the general public, but there are steps being made in some of the areas that might mean people more open to some of these things. One is John Conner's resolution to impeach Bush and Cheney. And there, in the Nation magazine, in the, I think it was January issue, has a front cover on it saying Impeach Bush, written by Elizabeth Holton. Holton, she was a former Democratic representative. And then
involved in the Nixon impeachment.
Yeah, she was part of the Nixon impeachment. And there was also a program on C-SPAN that interviewed, John Conyers, John Dean, Elizabeth Holtzman.
There's a criminal case we can bring against these people.
And then the editor of Harper's Magazine, the March issue, has a cover story on impeaching Bush. John F. Kennedy Jr.
Robert Kennedy Jr.
Right.
John F. Kennedy Jr. went down in a small plane.
Yeah. Robert Kennedy Jr. He did real big on the Ohio election.
Right. He's about the election in Iowa. Ohio,
right. Right.
And my point is that there are other issues that things are starting to be done about them because they're being brought into the public domain. So it just takes a matter of this getting into the public domain as well, because I don't think it's a lost cause, because there are people that are doing things about the voter, voting machines. And so some things, and there are some good Democrats that are doing things about this. So it just made the next step, make people aware of this kind of stuff, that they realize voting machines.
I agree, if you keep talking about it, I think you have to say, people, look, most people today haven't had a computer or access to the public library. Mm-hmm. And you tell people, I can only tell you this, you go prove it to yourself, but don't ignore the truth, don't ignore the facts, make up your mind. Because I think us baby boomers, I think we're going to have one more time, this is my own personal feeling, I think we're going to have to go to the streets one more time, and that's going to be it, whether or not. That's just my feeling. That's the feeling I have inside.
How about filling the city hall chamber when we call through, there are those of us who presented a resolution to the city, who have gone to one of the commissioners.
When is the?
We finished the last interview with Saltzman Thursday. Eric Sten is going to tell me when and if they're going to do this. When we first presented it to the county commission, Diane Lynn said, we got to get out of it. She's got three mean girls that anything she brings up, they're going to vote against. You got Lonnie Roberts, who voted the commission, passed a resolution to against the Patriot Act, which was a year in the doing. You know, Dr. Frankel, who lived this thing. Lonnie Roberts, out here, voted against it.
The idea is to get the impeachment going, but
what we're trying to do is to vote the bill support so that Hooley, DeFazio, and Blumenauer will co-sponsor H.R. 635. Wu co-sponsored in mid-March. There were, up to the time that Mayor Potter stood with his commissioners and said the FBI will not take over City Hall. There may be more. And we're part of the national impeachment.
Okay,
so what you have to do is here's Sam Adams. Why should the city do this resolution? And of course, he's devil's advocate because he's for it. And so you lay out why, including with Saltzman, the spreadsheets of how much federal dough we aren't getting. They're punishing the Beirut. Okay, so what you have to do is build that support so then you will do it. The Democratic leadership has said, no impeachment.
I know.
Peter DeFazio
they
has said,
leave.
As long as
we
have a Republican Congress, you're not going to get it. We said the first order of business has got to be in January 3rd, impeachment.
Well,
and you're not going to go for it.
How about one more and then we'll...
My statement is that this darn little video has done more, loose change, has done more to get this out than anything else. And I do, I think it's unbelievable. This is actually getting all over the net. Every computer has seen this thing, and it's being talked about everywhere. And so, bravo for this little video.
Good.
Yeah, I just want to bring up one more thing, and that is having neighborhood get-togethers and showing these films. That's what I did in my house. I live way over in Beaverton. And I invited all my neighbors over. I mean, I don't have very many people there.
Are you giving out?
But it's like a start.
Yeah. It is.
Get
that's
people
right.
aware
that's
of it.
That's right.
Jimmy Walters.
Oh, Jimmy Walters. Okay.
He opened 9 of us.
Well, let's use every avenue we have.
I would like to see Flight 93. Movie has been released. I think it's important to see.
Have you seen the movie?
Can you get the door open?
I will.
Yeah.
According to the official story, Flight 93 was headed for the White House when it was overpowered by a group of passengers and crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Out of all of the events of 9/11, the one that has caused the most confusion is Flight 93. It was shut down, it wasn't shut down. However, evidence suggests that perhaps Flight 93 was nowhere near Shanksville.
Now, I want to get quickly to Chris Konicki. He's a photographer with the Pittsburgh affiliate, the Fox affiliate. He was back there just a couple of minutes ago, and Chris, I've seen the pictures. It looks like there's nothing there except for a hole in the ground.
Basically, that's right. The only thing you can see from where we were was a big gouge in the earth and some broken trees. You can see some people walking around in the air.
Smoke, fire?
Nothing. It was absolutely quiet. It was actually very quiet. Nothing going on down there. No smoke, no fire. Just a couple of people walking around. They look like part of the NTSB crew walking around looking at the pieces.
How big would you say that hole was?
From my estimates, I would guess it was probably about 20 to 15 feet. Probably about 10 feet long or 10 feet wide.
What could you see on the ground, if anything, other than dirt and ash? And
you couldn't see anything. You could just see dirt, ash, and people walking around, broken trees.
Wally Miller, a Somerset County coroner, told the Houston Chronicle, "It looked like somebody just dropped a bunch of metal out of the sky." In the Washington Post, "It looked like someone took a scrap truck, dug a 10-foot ditch, and dumped trash into it. And as for the passengers, I stopped being coroner after about 20 minutes because there were no bodies there." In the Pittsburgh Review, "I have not, to this day, seen a single drop of blood. Not a drop."
From the Red Cross, which has a representative on site, "The first pictures of the crash scene show a large crater with the Boeing 737 broken into small pieces. The plane crashed shortly after taking off from Lagos in a heavy storm. The flight was going to the Nigerian capital of Abuja and was believed to be carrying some senior Nigerian officials."
So if Flight 90 Shanksville, then where? You ready for this? Cleveland. At 11:43 on September 11th, WCPO, a local TV station in Cincinnati, the two planes went into Cleveland. Are you confused? Well, it gets better. Check it out. At approximately 10 a.m., Cleveland Hopkins Airport was evacuated amidst rumors that a hijacked plane. Buses weren't allowed to leave. People were sent home. According to Associated Press and local Ohio papers, one plane landed at approximately 10:45. But Delta Airlines confirmed that their plane, Delta 1989, landed in Cleveland at 10:10. Therefore, Flight 93 landed in Cleveland at approximately 10:45. Authorities searched Delta 1989 for over 2 hours, and passengers were questioned individually. The plane dealer reported that the plane was evacuated at 12:30, but the Akron Beacon reports that a plane was evacuated at 11:15, which would make that Flight 93. Mayor White reported that the plane had 200 passengers. But a passenger from Delta 1989 described 60 or so passengers. So at 11:15, 200 or so passengers were released from Flight 93. The passenger from Delta 1989 states that she was taken into FAA headquarters. But other reports say the passengers were brought into the NASA Glenn Research Center, located near the west end of the airport, which had already been evacuated. So, to sum up, Delta 1989 landed at 10:10, was evacuated at 12:30, almost 2.5 hours later, and 69 passengers were taken to FAA headquarters. Flight 93 landed at 10:45 and evacuated within a half hour. 200 or so passengers quickly taken to an empty NASA research center. Why did it take 140 minutes to evacuate 69 passengers when 200 were evacuated in a half hour? We can assume that the passengers from Delta 1989 are safe somewhere. The question remains, what happened to the 200 or so passengers in Flight 93? It's interesting to note that the combined total of all the passengers from all four flights is 198, or 243, depending on who you ask. We may never know what really happened to Flight 93, but we do know what didn't happen.
Involvement of Al Qaeda.
Is this where we've moved into the oddities bit?
No.
So what happened to the people?
This is still 93.
What happened to the people?
Yeah, that's the question.
You mean they're never going
to
kill
this evidence is presented to people? You'll usually get one of many different questions. First one being,
there's never been plausible passenger
bits. The original ones. Unfortunately, we may never know what really happened. But if we can examine the black boxes from the planes that were used, we can prove that they weren't the original flights. A commercial plane carries two different black boxes. Each black box carries one of two different recorders. Cockpit voice recorder and a flight data recorder. The cockpit voice recorder records sounds from inside the cockpit, including engine noise, stall warnings, and other sounds of interest. Communications between air traffic control, weather briefings, and conversations between pilots and crew are also recorded. The flight data recorder records at least 28 different parameters, such as time, altitude, speed, and heading. Some also record more than 300 other in-flight characteristics, anything from autopilot to smoke alarm. Recorders themselves are made from the most impervious metals known to man, and the information is recorded along with date and time and spooled into a continuous roll. Any damage that is done to the roll is done to the outside, as opposed to the inside where the data is. The 9/11 Commission says the CVRs and FDRs from American 11 and United 175 were not found. Yet, the FBI claims to have found the passport of Saddam al-Sakami, which managed to fly out of his pocket through the explosion and onto the streets of Manhattan below. So, four different black boxes, made from the most resilient materials known to man, were destroyed. Yet, a passport, made from a fragile material known as paper, managed to survive. Who writes this stuff? Ted Lepakiewicz, spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board, told CBS News that it's extremely rare that we don't get the recorders back. I can't recall another domestic case in which we did not recover the recorders. It turns out Ted's right. Nicholas DeMassey, firefighter who helped the recovery efforts, claims in the book Behind the Scenes, Ground Zero, at one point I was assigned to take federal agents around the site to search for the black boxes from the planes. There were a total of four black boxes. We found three. I guess it all comes down to who you'd rather believe. FBI Director Robert Mueller said Flight 77's data recorder provided altitude, speed, headings, and other information, but the voice recorder contained nothing useful. And Donald Rumsfeld said the data on the cockpit voice recorder was unrecoverable. Flight 93, it was the only flight where the cockpit voice recorder was recovered. It was played for the families in April 2002, but not before they signed an agreement saying that they wouldn't talk about it. They couldn't even take notes. And for some reason, the last 3 minutes of the tape was unaccounted for. The FBI had no explanation for the discrepancy. Why would the 9/11 Commission tell us Flight 11-175's recorders weren't found? Why would Robert Mueller tell us that there's nothing interesting on Flight 77's? What's on the last 3 minutes of Flight 93's cockpit voice recorder? These are vital questions that need to be answered. It's an interesting postscript that Flight 93 was spotted on April 10th, 2003 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport by David Friedman, a United Airlines employee who records all of his flights. The tail number, N591UA, was spotted on Flight 1111, a United Airlines 757. And according to the FAA, both N591UA and N612UA, Flights 93 and 175, are still valid. But Flights 11 and 77 are listed as destroyed. Not to mention that they were not even scheduled to fly on September 11th. Next, what about the cell phone calls? For starters, the calls themselves are extremely peculiar. Most of them are only a couple sentences long for the callers and the conversation, only to call back later. Flight attendant Betty Ong allegedly placed a call from Flight 11. According to the 9/11 Commission, although the conversation lasted 23 minutes, only 4.5 minutes was recorded.
What is your name?
Okay, my name is Betty Ong. I'm number 3 on Flight 11.
Okay.
And the cockpit is not answering your phone. And there's somebody down in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. Somebody's got mates or something. Okay. Our number one is got staff. Our customer staff. Nobody knows the staff too, and we can't leave just the business class right now because nobody can breathe. Our number one is the staff right now.
Okay.
So, and our number five, our first class passengers, our first class galley flight attendant and our purser is in staff. And we can't get the cockpit, the door won't open.
Does Ms. Ong sound like a woman on a hijacked plane who just saw 3 people murdered? Why is nobody in the background screaming? Flight attendant Madeline Sweeney allegedly talked to the ground manager Michael Woodward for 25 minutes. She describes 4 hijackers. The FBI says there were 5. She says the hijackers were in rows 9 and 10. The FAA says they were all in row 8. Near the end, she screams, "I see buildings. Water. Oh my God." Madeline was a flight attendant out of Boston for 12 years. I think she would have recognized Manhattan. A man claiming to be Mark Bingham called his mother, Alice, who is visiting his sister-in-law. The caller says, "Mom, this is Mark Bingham. When was the last time you called your mother and used your full name? I just want to tell you that I love you. I'm on a flight from Newark to San Francisco, and there are 3 guys on board, and they say they've taken over the plane, and they say they have a bomb. I'm calling you from the airphone. You believe me, don't you, Mark?" "Yes, Mark, I believe you. Who are these guys?" Then he was interrupted by someone who was speaking in a low-toned male voice, speaking what sounded like English. After 30 seconds of muffled sounds, the caller repeats, "I'm calling you with an airphone." His mother asks him again, "Who are these guys?" After another pause, he returns and asks again, "You believe me, don't you, Mom?" There was another pause, and the phone just trailed off. To date, none of these calls, except for Betty Ong's call to American Airlines, has been released to the public. But to be honest, none of that matters. Why? Because none of these calls could have taken place. Keith Dewey of physics911.net conducted some research of his own. In an experiment called Project Achilles, he took a series of cell phones onto a Cessna 172 and flew up to 8,000 feet to determine the success rate as the plane got higher. At 4,000 feet, he had a 0.4 success rate. At 8,000 feet, he had a 0.1 success rate. For 32,000 feet, cruising altitude for a commercial airliner, he calculated a 0.006 success rate, less than 1/100th of a chance. Don't believe me? Even American Airlines has put their foot in the government's mouth. On July 15, 2004, passengers aboard a commercial American Airlines flight were able to send and receive calls from their cell phones as if they were on the ground, thanks to a cell station that was installed into the plane. It worked great. I called the office, I called my wife, I called a friend in Paris. They all heard and could hear them loud and clear.
Why would American Airlines spend thousands of dollars on this technology in 2004 when cell phones worked so well on September 11, 2001? The cell phone calls were fake, no question about it. So how is it possible to fake a person's voice? In 1999, the Los Alamos Laboratory in New Mexico revealed their voice morphing technology. General Carl W. Steiner, the former commander-in-chief of the United States Special Operations, declared on tape, "Gentlemen, we have called you together to inform you that we are going to overthrow the United States government." Another example was Colin Powell saying, "I am being treated well by my captors." With just a 10-minute recording of somebody's voice, they are able, in almost real time, to clone someone's speech. Steiner was so impressed, he asked for a copy. So what about the hijackers? On September 14, 2001, the Department of Justice released the names of these alleged 19 hijackers. But on September 23rd, the BBC reported that Waleed Al-Sherry was alive and well in Casablanca, Morocco. They also tracked down Abdulaziz Al-Amari, who was an engineer with Saudi Telecom and lost his passport while studying in Denver. In the same article, FBI Director Robert Mueller admitted that the identity of several of the hijackers is in doubt. So how many hijackers turned up alive? At least 9 of them. Waleed Al-Sherry is alive and well. Mohand Al-Sherry is alive in Saudi Arabia. Khaled Al-Midar is a computer programmer in Mecca. Salem Al-Hazmi works at a chemical plant in Yanbu, Saudi Arabia. Saeed Al-Ghamdi is training to be a pilot in Tunis. Ahmed Al-Nami is an administrative supervisor for Saudi Airlines. We already covered Waleed and Abdulaziz. And last but not least, Mohammed Atta's father claimed to receive a phone call from the son on September 12th. On September 20th and 27th, Mueller admitted on CNN that there is no legal proof to prove the identities of the hijackers. Indeed, after all, not even the official autopsy for Flight 77 lists the hijackers. And the opening paragraph makes no mention of their absence. So, if there's no proof that the hijackers were members of Al-Qaeda, or if they were even on the plane in the first place, what justification do we have for bombing Afghanistan? Oh, that's right. The Bin Laden confession tape. On December 14th, 2001,
so that was Flight 93.
Yeah,
so. Okay. Just got an hour. Well, I think this is a good point to discuss the possible perpetrators of this. And how
many. Everybody spoke.
I think this presentation by Michael Rupert gives you an overview of how to look at an investigation, because after all, just people have died. It should be a homicide investigation, mm-hmm. and it should be something.
But they were doing their thing on me.
That we,
Mike Rupert,
cover in a way.
Staff of me and his brain too for advice and counsel. So I am very pleased to bring Mike Rupert on, and he will probably knock your skin. We are
about to. Sorry, I accidentally.
They were doing their thing okay. on me.
So, of course, they smeared her when she came out.
Whose shoulder was there for me, and his brain, too, for advice and counsel. So, I am very pleased to bring Mike Rupert on, and he will probably knock your socks off.
Almost all of us are deeply aware of and disturbed by the glaring inconsistencies, the evidence tampering, the obstruction of justice, the nonfeasance, the malfeasance, and the other crimes represented by the final report of the Cain Commission investigating the attacks of September the 11th. I will not digress to discuss them here, but for the record, I would like it noted that the entire membership of the Cain Commission is horribly and blatantly compromised by often egregious conflicts of interest that would have made them ineligible for participation in the tribunal charged with rendering a full accounting of the events of 9/11. Their conduct in the discharge of their duties was a shameful and criminal affirmation of those vested interests. Since the day of the attacks, my newsletter from the Wilderness, reinforced by an incredible staff of writers and editors, has worked virtually nonstop to investigate those attacks and to produce reasonable answers based upon evidence that will help fill the enormous void left by mainstream news organizations, the Congress, and the Kane Commission. As most of you know, my long-awaited book, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, has just recently been completed, and even as we speak today, the printing is starting in Canada. So we're very happy to see that. I am especially. We have been accepting advance orders for a week, and the first shipment should go out by September 14th. So those of you who have been waiting for that book, which is 700 pages long with 1,000 footnotes, plenty for all of you to digest, challenge, and do whatever you want to do with, it'll be available for you shortly, and we certainly hope before November 2nd. I don't know why I'd say so. You can find information about the book at the website fromthewilderness.com. I believe that Crossing the Rubicon provides amply documented evidence with which to initiate and sustain a number of indictments of top-level government officials for their roles in facilitating the attacks of 9/11. Most notably, as my chief suspect, I name Vice President Richard Cheney as both the planner and executor of those attacks. In order to complete my book, I chose to focus on a clear and unmistakable evidentiary record based upon written records, statements of key officials, evidence presented under oath in first-person interviews, and investigations conducted by me directly in pursuit of information that discloses the truth about September the 11th. In writing Crossing the Rubicon, I decided that the primary audience that I wanted to reach was the American people as a whole. Thought it best to present them with a book that I could say was legally admissible in court on its face, since no interpretation was required and no chain of custody issues presented themselves with regards to footnotes or verifiable records. The possibility of evidence tampering has been removed, since all footnotes lead either to verifiable public record sources or are the work product of interviews conducted and recorded by me that I recount in the book as I would sworn testimony of a detective under oath. Let me begin by briefly summarizing my findings, briefly, and disclosing information which has never been made public until today. Crossing the Rubicon is a detective story that gets to the innermost core of the 9/11 attacks. It places 9/11 at the center of a desperate new America created by specific named individuals in preparation for peak oil, an economic crisis like nothing the world has ever seen. It looks at the crime from the viewpoint of a homicide investigator, who must, in order to establish guilt, examine and identify the motive, means, and opportunity for the commission of the crime. The attacks of September 11, 2001 were the pretext for the American and, to a lesser extent, the British and the Israeli empires to begin seizing by force those energy supplies needed to sustain their power, hegemony, whether regional or global, and their teetering economies. Both governments were involved well before the attacks occurred. The attacks of 9/11 were accomplished through an amazing orchestration of logistics and personnel. Former National Security Advisor and Counterterror Advisor Richard Clark has postulated that such a conspiracy could never be kept a secret. Too many people would have been involved, he insisted in his recent book, Against All Enemies. On this point, I disagree with Clark completely. I point to the fact that the Manhattan Project, which developed the atom bomb, and the Stealth Fighter Project were both successfully kept secret. The numbers of people involved in both of those projects far exceeded the numbers of people within the United States government required to execute 9/11. However, I must express a deep debt of gratitude for Richard Clark. For in his book, he left a very compelling trail of breadcrumbs, contradictions to the sworn testimony and written records submitted, often under oath, of our highest leaders, and the hard evidence which provided me with the leads I needed to break open and answer the whodunit part. 9/11. For me, the pivotal evidence, absolutely demonstrating direct government complicity in and management of the attacks, was found in a number of undisputed yet virtually unaddressed war games that I have shown were being conducted, coordinated, and or controlled by Vice President Dick Cheney or his immediate staff on the morning of September the 11th. The names of those war games are known to include Vigilant Guardian, Vigilant Warrior, Northern Guardian, Northern Vigilance, and Tripod 2. There is a possibility that Northern Guardian, excuse me, is a duplicate name, but the remaining exercises are indisputably separate events with different objectives. All have been reported by major press organizations relying on undisputed quotes from participating military and FAA personnel. They have also been confirmed by NORAD press releases. All, except for Northern Vigilance and Tripod 2, had to do with hijacked airliners inside the continental United States, specifically within the Northeast Air Defense Sector, or NEADS, where all four 9/11 hijackings occurred. According to a clear record, some of these exercises involve commercial airline hijackings. In some cases, false blips or injects were deliberately inserted onto FAA and military radar screens, and they were present during at least the first attacks.
Does everyone understand that the screens that they were looking at had false little flashes of light put on there? That's what he's talking about right now? It's kind of going to be important if we have a chance to get all the way to the end of this.
Excuse me. This effectively paralyzed fighter response. Because with only 8 fighters available in the region, there were as many as 22 possible hijackings taking place. Other exercises, specifically Northern Vigilance, had pulled significant fighter resources away from the Northeast U.S. just before 9/11 into Northern Canada and Alaska. In addition, a close reading of key news stories published in the spring of 2004 revealed for the first time that some of these drills were live fly exercises where actual aircraft, likely flown by remote control, were simulating behavior of hijacked airliners in real life. All of this as the real attacks began. The fact that these exercises had never been systematically and thoroughly explored in the mainstream press, or publicly by Congress, or at least publicly in any detail whatsoever by the so-called Independent 9/11 Commission, made me think that they might be the holy grail of 9/11. And that's exactly what they turned out to be. Only one war game exercise, Vigilant Guardian, was mentioned in a footnote to the Cain Commission report, and that it was deliberately mislabeled as an exercise intended to intercept Russian bombers instead of a hijack exercise in the Northeast Sector. Even then, a deliberate lie was told to the American people as NORAD commander General Ralph Eberhardt testified to the commission that the exercise actually expedited U.S. Air Force response during the attacks. Before the commission's final hearing, I undertook a direct investigation in an attempt to learn more details about each of the exercises and specifically who was controlling them or had planned them to take place on September the 11th, where it's abundantly clear, based upon the record of statements made by the U.S. Air Force and FAA personnel, that the games had effectively paralyzed fighter response during the attacks. While most of my queries, including the submission of direct written questions and telephone calls to NORAD, the Department of Defense, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, resulted in stonewalling. That's a kind word. And did little to help clarify this key issue. One military officer revealed information that was, to say the least, startling. It confirmed my findings. After several phone calls, and lengthy emails laying out what I had uncovered, I received a written response from 1st Air Force Public Affairs Officer Major Don Arias. In that response, he confirmed that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had been conducting a live fly hijack drill on the day of September the 11th. The name of that exercise, Vigilant Warrior, had been revealed by Richard Clark on page 9 of his book as he quoted a statement made to him by then-acting Joint Chiefs Chairman Richard Myers. To excerpt from Major Arias' May 14, 2004 email addressed to me, Mr. Rupert, the book is in the mail. It's an Air Force book which describes a completely different set of attacks than the one the King Commission investigated. The NORAD-wide exercise we were in on 9/11 was indeed Vigilant Guardian. I also learned something that may help you with your research. The terms used for NORAD exercises have specific meanings. Per NORAD Instruction 33-7, nicknames. Quote, a combination of two separate unclassified words, which is assigned an unclassified meaning, and is employed for unclassified administration of morale or public information, the first word must begin with the combination of letters of the alphabet allocated to the using agency. It's all mil-speak, as they call it. A nickname is used exclusively to designate a drill or exercise. Exercise terms are used to prevent confusion between exercise directives with actual operations. That's a key sentence because they have to separate the exercises from real life, at least they're supposed to. Vigilant or amalgam means it is a HQ and headquarters NORAD-sponsored exercise. Guardian means it is a multi-command CPX or command post exercise, meaning there's no live fly. So on 9/11, NORAD was conducting NORAD-wide multi-command command post exercises with no live flies. This covers the radar injects that were present on the FAA radar screens throughout New England and the Northeast sector on that day. Other exercise terms include warrior, JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, headquartered NORAD, sponsored field training exercise, or FTX, or live fly. Because First Air Force CONAR is an intermediate level of command, I may have to refer your questions to HQ NORAD, but I'll do what I can. But what he said was, we have General Richard Myers saying, vigilant warrior, we're in the middle of it. Richard Clark wrote it in the book. A NORAD officer here confirms that that was a live fly hijack drill in progress during the attacks. Have you ever heard of that before? Any of you? The full text in this of this and other correspondence and my direct questioning of DOD and military personnel is included in Crossing the Rubicon. Major areas is going to be mentioned again very quickly here. What we have in this instance is direct written confirmation of a live fly exercise that involved the actual piloting of aircraft either by remote control or with real pilots in the Northeast Air Defense Sector. There are multiple confirmations of this, which are in the book. Other exercises use the injects, confusing both FAA and NORAD radar screens. And this would account for well-documented confusion over what might have been 22 different possible hijackings. It was impossible for the FAA or the Air Force personnel to tell which was which. With only 8 fighter aircraft available, the inexplicable delays in fighter response are now easy to comprehend. When New York writer Michael Caine, who I believe is here today, wherever you are, Mike, God bless you, approached General Everhart on an FTW assignment for my newsletter at the conclusion of the Commission's last public hearing and asked for information on all the other exercises, including the Vigilant Warrior, Everhart's only response was, no comment. Other government agencies have fallen back on a simple, the exercise is a classified excuse and failed to provide any clarification at all. Same with the Caine Commission, several members of which were also questioned by Mike Caine. Nobody would talk. There was also an additional non-military biowarfare exercise called Tripod 2 being set up in Manhattan on September 11th, and it was under the direct coordination of FEMA and by White House directive, the immediate control of the Vice President, Richard Cheney. The setup for that exercise conveniently placed a fully staffed FEMA New York City Department of Justice command post on Manhattan's Pier 29, just in time for it to be conveniently used as the command post after the Twin Towers had collapsed. In reconstructing actual communications and chains of commands, I was extremely disturbed to find out that many officials in a position to take action that might have prevented the loss of life in the South Tower did not do so before Flight 175 became the second impact. This in spite of the fact that it was known and had been clearly communicated that Flight 175 had been off course, hijacked, and headed toward Manhattan for some 20 minutes. Included here are Vice President Richard Cheney, various NORAD officers and commanders, the FAA, and then Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. In examining transcripts of Giuliani's testimony before the Caine Commission, I find clear evidence suggesting that Mayor Giuliani committed perjury when he appeared before the Caine Commission this spring. It's interesting to note that of all 9/11 witnesses whose testimony I analyzed, his testimony remain to this day the only testimony which has not been transcribed and presented to the public. Instead, I was forced to rely on transcripts prepared from video and audio recordings by 9/11 activists and researchers. I will now quote from Crossing the Rubicon as to what my analysis of Giuliani's testimony revealed. It may explain why the Caine Commission has deliberately withheld it from public view. I want to thank first Kyle Henson, Joe Friendly, who provided me with a written transcript of Giuliani's remarks, which I might add was independently verified through other recordings. We began, according to Giuliani, sometime after Flight 77 struck the Pentagon. Quote, I had already been informed by my chief of staff that he had reached the White House and by the police commissioner, who I think had reached the Defense Department. I I'm not sure exactly. But both of them had assured me that we had gotten air support because that's why I wanted to reach the White House. I wanted to make sure that we had air defense for the city. And my chief of staff told me that he was informed by the White House that there were 7 planes that were unaccounted for. At this point, I knew of 2, and I heard reports that the Pentagon had been attacked, that the Sears Tower had been attacked, and several other things. Now, who had told, I'm speaking now, who had told Giuliani about the 2 missing planes before this? Such information must have originated with NORAD, NEEDS, or the FAA. Those communications channels were obviously functioning at that time, but then why no warning? The only likely explanation here is that lower command levels, knowing that the National Command Authority, the White House, and the Pentagon had taken command, assumed that the warnings would come from higher up and thus be more quickly heeded. Now we go back to Giuliani. So I got through to the White House. Chris Hennick was on the phone, who was the deputy political director to President Bush. And I said to him, Chris, was the Pentagon attacked? And he said, confirmed. Nope, the Pentagon was struck at 9:41. And then I asked him if we had air support. I said, do we have air support? Do you have jets up? Because I think we're going to get hit again. He said, quote, the jets were dispatched 12 minutes ago, and they should be there very shortly, and they should be able to defend you against further attack. And then he said, we're evacuating the White House, and the vice president will call you back very shortly. Note a number of mainstream press accounts. This is me. Fix the White House evacuation order between 9:41 and 9:45. I think it was a lot earlier. Thus, there are 2 events fixing Giuliani's conversation with Hennick between 9:41 and 9:45. Are we to assume that no one in the White House had Giuliani's telephone number? He was a major player in the Republican Party, a strong supporter of George W. Bush. Why was he talking to a political director and not to the Pentagon or the Situation Room and the White House? Clark was there. Rice was there. The Situation Room was hooked up to NORAD, the Pentagon, the FAA, the FBI, everybody. He or somebody on his staff had the numbers. The problem with the Giuliani-Hennick call is that its timing is bounded by 3 parameters that don't fit. The call starts sometime after the Pentagon was hit at 9:41. Hennick tells Giuliani that fighters were dispatched 12 minutes ago to protect you, i.e. New York City, and we know that the only fighters sent to New York were sent from Otis Air Force Base at 8:46. 12 minutes after that would be 8:58. South Tower was struck at 9:03. The end of the Giuliani-Hennick call is followed immediately by the start of the Cheney-Giuliani call, see below, and the immediate collapse of the World WTC Tower at South Tower at 9:59. For the sake of argument, let's say that this conversation occurred 5 minutes after the Pentagon was struck. That would mean that the White House told Giuliani that fighter aircraft had been scrambled and sent to New York 7 minutes after 9:37 or 9:41, depending upon which timeline is used, or between 9:44 and 9:48. The final Kane Commission report, released on July 22nd, makes no mention of any fighters being sent to New York at this time. The only scramble order even close to Giuliani's account is the scrambling of fighters from Langley Air Force Base to protect Washington at 9:23, roughly matches the time of the end of Giuliani's conversation with Hennick. The former mayor's testimony appears to be referring to the Otis fighters that had been directed to establish a combat air patrol over New York. But that poses another problem, a big one. If this is the case, then Giuliani's testimony places the Otis scramble order almost an hour later than the official NORAD and NEEDS accounts, Northeast Air Defense Sector. Were these some other fighter aircraft? If so, they have not been mentioned. And why did Hennick not mention the Otis fighters that were, according to NORAD and eyewitness accounts, Giuliani should have been able to see and hear them. Every other New Yorker saw them. Are we to believe that Giuliani somehow remained oblivious to the fighters' presence? Are we to believe that no police or fire official told him that the fighters were there, that he couldn't hear them? The only available benchmarks suggest that the call from Cheney took place much earlier than Giuliani claims. If we reference it to when the scramble order was issued at Otis Air Force Base, the source of New York's fighter cover, 8:46 a.m., then Giuliani spoke to Hennick sometime around 8:58 or about 5 minutes before Flight 175 struck at 9:03. If Hennick knew about other missing planes, he was obviously getting information, at least indirectly, from NORAD and NEEDS. From whom? A political guy getting this information. The Secret Service seems the most likely candidate since there are numerous records of their active involvement by this time. At that time, it was also known that Flight 175 had been en route to Lower Manhattan for 16 minutes. There is no mention of Hennig issuing any warning to the New York mayor that a second plane was about to attack. How could the White House staffer have been certain about 12 minutes unless there had been a log? He was precise. Where is that log? Why was a political staffer in possession of better data than the mayor of New York? What does this suggest, then, about the timing of the call that Giuliani then received from Dick Cheney immediately after talking to Hennig, according to Giuliani? And I put down the phone and within seconds got a call in another room from the vice president. I walked over to that room, picked up the phone. The White House operator was on the phone and said, "Mr. Mayor, the vice president will be on in a moment." At that point, I heard a click. The desk started to shake, and I heard next, and I heard Chief Esposito, who was the uniformed head of the police department. I'm sure it was his voice. I heard him say, "The South Tower is down. The tower has come down." The South Tower collapsed at 9:59 and was recorded live by a multitude of cameras. This is confirmation that Cheney was making command decisions and in all communications loops at least by this time. But if the White House call took place at 8:58, then more likely, in conformity with what we have already established, Dick Cheney was actually hands-on much, much sooner. As we have seen, Cheney was already in that role between 8:45, according to the FAA, and no later than about 9:15. The Secret Service, which had snatched Cheney out of his office after Flight 175 hit at 9:03, was fully informed of all developments, and they never left Dick Cheney's side. Quoting Giuliani, "So the police commissioner and I and the deputy police commissioner, we jointly decided we had to try to get everyone out of the building. So we went downstairs into the basement. We tried two or three exits, could not get out. I don't know if they were locked or blocked, but we couldn't get out." Here is more agonizing confirmation that no evacuation warnings had been issued for either tower prior to 9:02. Yet full knowledge of the danger was available to the National Command Authority that Flight 175 had turned toward New York at 8:42. 20 silent minutes passed when many of those who died could have been saved. The failure to warn the occupants of the South Tower in spite of what is now an irrefutable record is not only a grave insult to the people of New York, but the implications are compounded by the fact that Major Don Arias, the same NORAD officer who provided me with written confirmation of a live flight exercise, had a brother working inside the World Trade Center during the attacks. While the entire National Command System failed to issue any warning to the people in the World Trade Center, Major Arias was compelled to leave his post long enough to place a phone call over a standard phone line to call his brother to warn him to get out of the building. Nobody else would do it. All of this is abundantly documented in Crossing the Rubicon. There are many, many other instances of criminal conduct on the part of our government on September 11th and since. I could talk about the still unresolved issue of massive insider trading on the world's financial markets. I could talk about a multitude of specific warnings that were received but ignored by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and the entire administration. I could talk about how retired FBI Special Agent John O'Neill was kept up drinking until 2:30 in the morning on the night before the attacks, in a pattern very reminiscent of what happened with several Secret Service agents assigned to protect President John Kennedy on November 22, 1963. One of the most insulting omissions of the King Commission is its failure to even discuss a $100,000 wire transfer to Muhammad Atta just a few days before the attack at the order of then of the head of Pakistan's intelligence services, the ISI, or that, as Paul mentioned, General Ahmad was having breakfast with Porter Goss, the man who is now being put forth to head our Central Intelligence Agency. But one thing I am certain of, and I believe I have proven the case beyond a reasonable doubt in Crossing the Rubicon, I am certain, I am absolutely certain that Richard Cheney was not only a planner in the attacks, but also that on the day of the attacks, he was running a completely separate command and control and communication system which was superseding any orders being issued by the National Military Command Center, that's the Pentagon, or the White House Situation Room. To accomplish that end, he relied on a redundant and superior communication system maintained by the United States Secret Service in or near the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the bunker, to which he and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice were reportedly rushed sometime after Flight 175 struck the South Tower. I will demonstrate that the Secret Service possessed radar screens which gave them and the Vice President, whose side they never left, real-time information as good or better than anything available to the Pentagon, the FAA, or anybody else, and that it was on the basis of that information that Cheney overrode and took complete operational control on September the 11th. I have shown that in what are called national special security events. I encourage you to all Google that on your computers. The U.S. Secret Service is the supreme U.S. agency for operational control with complete authority over the military and all civilian agencies. I have established conclusively that in May 2001, by presidential order, Richard Cheney was put in direct command and control of all war game and field exercise training and scheduling through several agencies, especially FEMA. This also extended to all of the conflicting and overlapping NORAD drills. I will also demonstrate that the tripod exercise being set up on September 10th in Manhattan was directly connected to Cheney's role in number three above. By sheer dedication and sacrifice through endless hours of labor and uncounted sleepless nights, a great many true Americans have kept 9/11 on the table. There's a few of them right here, here, there. 9/11 on the table for review and examination by the people of the world, and especially the people of America. It remains a clear and irrefutable challenge for all of us to persevere, to remain steadfast, to demand accountability, and to take whatever personal risks are necessary to see justice done and to unravel the confusing, perilous, and often frightening world which has presented itself to us in the years since. You're welcome for your questions.
Michael Rupert living here in Oregon.
Ashland.
Yeah. So just so you know, he was an LA, ex-LA cop detective, and now he's here. It's a little bit spendy to get him to come and speak anymore. It's $5,000 for a speaking engagement. But he starts early and he'll stay until the very last question is asked. He can outlast anybody. I haven't seen him in person, but I read a lot of him. What he's written. Crossing the Rubicon is like this, and it is fascinating read. I just want to mention the notice how he discussed the command structure. It was just like one of those all those things that Bush has been signing since he came into office. Cheney was put in command of all these different, you know, FEMA. Did you guys know that? The Secret Service. So essentially, there's this parallel command structure with people that are accountable to Cheney in this whole morass. And so you'd think that, yeah, well, naysayers say, oh, you could never keep a conspiracy like that secret from all the military chiefs and all of that. Well, if there's a structure in place of people only accountable to one, you know, head, then seems more likely, doesn't it? Now, there's a Q&A here that I just...
Any proof yet that bin Laden was responsible for September 11th?
From a criminal standpoint, in terms of the way you would approach it to court of law, which is how I approach everything, the answer is no. The case has not been made. I believe Osama bin Laden has been and remains a CIA asset. And protect.
Just hold a little applause for 1 minute. Paul, any comments?
As you may guess from my earlier talk, I see a lot of evidence of knowledge of the attacks in Afghanistan in the months before 9/11. However, Osama bin Laden appears to be more of a spiritual figure, a symbolic leader. We can see a lot of other people who we could call masterminds who would be way ahead of the list, in my opinion, over him.
Thank you.
Michael Rupert, what is the mechanism by which the military inserted blips onto the civilian radar screen?
Well, specifically in terms of the technology, it's difficult to say. What we do know is that there are several press stories quoting Air Force personnel, specifically from the Northeast Air Defense Sector, and I believe one was a story. Most of these came from the Toronto Star, papers that didn't publish in the U.S. But what it said was, it was quoting interviews with Lieutenant Colonel Don Deskins, and Colonel Robert Marr of the Northeast Air Defense Sector about how they were wondering if the hijackings were part of the exercise of the drill. And then it says, instantly injects are purged from the radar screen. And then it refers later on. So what we have is a confirmation that there were actual injects placed onto FAA radar screens that day. Now, it's very interesting, parenthetically, and I know we're pressed for time, but it's very important to note that right after I made some presentations about the war games and wrote some information about this, it was revealed that a supervisor at the FAA headquarters in Rome, New York, in Northeast Air Defense Sector, had all six air traffic controllers involved on 9/11 sit down and talk about their recollections into a tape recorder that day, while it was still fresh. And right after I broke my stories, the New York Times reported that that tape was taken by that same supervisor, broken, crushed. The tape was cut into little pieces and scattered through various trash cans. But what I was able to do, I think, was make a pretty compelling case that it was an absolute torment for all of the air traffic controllers on 9/11 who were literally looking at their screens going, my God, which are the hijackings? Which is the drill? Where do we send the fighters?
Mike, in your opinion, is there a marriage between Wall Street, CIA, and the militant Islamic networks?
Well, first of all, the CIA is Wall Street. And Wall Street is the CIA. There is no difference. I got a whole chapter on that in the book. It's a real eye-opener. But I think I look at this historically. Congresswoman McKinney served on the House International Relations Committee. And I know that you had pretty good terms with Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California.
Yes.
And I document along where Dana Rohrabacher absolutely incensed about how the U.S. was deliberately supporting the Taliban and al-Qaeda with arms and cutting off the arms to anybody who opposed al-Qaeda, was literally almost slamming his shoe like Nikita Khrushchev did on the table, chewing out a State Department official. He was after a guy named Carl Inderforth, who was in my book, saying it's Pakistan, 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 meaning that the United States government, through the CIA, with its relationship with the ISI, was deliberately acting as a nurse, if you will, suckling and protecting the Taliban and making sure that it grew.
The terrorists and bin Laden have obviously declared war on the U.S. What do they want, number one? Wars are usually started to gain something. What do they hope to gain?
Okay. Well, first of all, I do not accept the construct that 19 Muslim hijackers perpetrated the attacks of 9/11 out of a cave in Afghanistan. What we are faced with, though, is what some people, and I don't agree with this completely, a concept called blowback, in which many of these Muslim fundamentalist organizations were deliberately created by the United States government through covert policy in the late 70s, early 80s, throughout the Afghani-Soviet insurgency, where people like Zbigniew Brzezinski were, you know, boasting about it. I mean, that's where we see radical hate books that are used in some Muslim schools having been printed at the University of Nebraska under the same contract that was printing oil drilling manuals for UNICAL. Which is true. By the same token, I was a policeman in South Central Los Angeles, and I will say that if you stand on anybody's neck long enough, they're going to get upset and they're going to try and fight back. That is a legitimate human right of self-defense. What anybody, I think, wants, and I'm not advocating terrorism in any form or violence in any form, but what I'm saying is that some people fight back, and certainly there were terrorists who wanted to attack the United States before 9/11, there are probably five times that many since 9/11, based solely upon the conduct of the United States government in world affairs since.
John?
True. True enough. Well, that sort of speaks for itself in the sense that the statistics bear out that terrorism has gone rampage now since 9/11. And it's a terrible shame. But we're coming into our last bit here, and I just wanted to take this moment to think about what we can do and what we're up against. Well, we've seen what we're up against, and what is there left in our toolbox?
You got your lights?
Yeah, sure, for a minute while I get this sort of...
By the way, that DVD is wonderful. What is that DVD called?
It's called The Citizens Commission.
Okay.
And it's from, they did a number of those, the Citizens Inquiry.
They're having one in Chicago right now, or?
Yeah. I guess, is that one of them? Yeah. And this one was done in 2004, just when, I guess Rupert was just finishing his book, and it was in September of 2004. So, can everyone see this now?
That is not available for us. That's something that we'll have to get on our own, that thing there that you've
Well,
got there.
I can make a copy for you. It's,
wow.
It's a good one. The whole rest of it is good. I wish we could show some more of it, and maybe we will on another occasion. Since loose change is so easy to get, I figure many people can get that. Do you know how to? Oh, okay. It's on.
I've never used the video.
Okay.
Only used the.
Okay, DVD. I'll fiddle with it in a sec. I just want to make a couple do a quick plug, and that is two things. Tomorrow night at First Unitarian Church, Greg Palast will be here in town. He's a renowned author who is most renowned for breaking the story about the purge of the voter rolls in Florida in 2000. And Glenn is holding up a fashionable flyer that we brought. If you can go, it's a sliding scale, $8 to $15, and it's going to help out the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, a band of very hardworking people. I count myself luckily among them. They're doing amazing work involving getting our votes to be, our elections in Oregon to be verified, because we have machines with secret software counting our votes right here in Oregon. There's no verification. There's no check. Only a little bit of testing they do ahead of time that's sort of a dog and pony show, really, when you look at it. So there's two things. There's the yellow sheet, which is a call to action. It gives a complete explanation of what to do if you're willing to help out. And also, please grab one of those little envelopes back there. It's a free CD that I made for everyone who's here. That is an audio version of the next speaker, which is Mark Crispin Miller. And he's our best expert in the land, in my view, on the stolen election of 2004. So take that, listen to it, love it. It's similar to the 9/11. And then you'll start to put it all together and say, well, if they can do 9/11, they can do this election. Compromise, right. Like it's a pickpocket ring.
Right.
You know, this is just small change stuff. And they have done it. So the key is, what are we going to do? Take up our pitchforks and torches? Are we going to try to get our elections back and do it and keep our civilization and try to go peacefully to change this horrible, horrible government that we have right now?
Well, pitchforks and torches, I think, is better.
Well, okay, but we have a spectrum, right? We've got voting, peaceful elections, peaceful activism, and then we've got the pitchforks and everything. So where are you on this spectrum? I still have hope for the elections, okay? So let's see what we have to do.
You know, Bobby Kennedy's article in Rolling Stone, I would say about 80% of it is based on Conyers' report. He's got the Kennedy name, and God bless him.
Good, yeah.
It's cheaper than buying the book.
Yeah.
Which is in paperback.
Yeah. Okay, it turns out that I have to change this over.
Are you sure?
Yeah, talk amongst yourselves.
Discuss.
Talk.
Let me add something that we can do what many of us don't know about 9/11 here. The group that's behind 9/11truth.org has set up a new website called the Citizens Counter Coup. And what they are doing each month is on the 11th of the month, they have a task which people who belong to this counter who can send to their representatives a specific issue, asking them to do something, and also sending to the media a letter or something about something specific that the media can do. So if you're interested in that, there is on, again, 911truth.org, this Citizens Counter Coup, which is working to get 9/11. Now, this is across the whole United States. They're trying to get people in every state to contact their legislators and the media and get more about 9/11.
I've looked at that Citizens Counter Coup, and it's
very... He's already got picture. You're good.
Oh, right.
I tell you right now, you're on. See?
Yes. Okay, likes if you like.
See you later, man.
I'm getting... Okay, so he's talking a little bit about the planning before the 2004 election had to do with all these evangelicals, right?
There were 4 million evangelicals. 4 million who had not voted before the 2000. And the party's hand here was to get those 4 million to come out and vote for Bush. Well, let's be generous and pretend that they succeeded in getting all 4 million evangelicals to vote for Bush. Let's even be more generous and say that they let those 4 million voters vote for Bush twice. Still doesn't explain the 11.5 million. I mean, something is past to be fishy here. And there were exit polls in 5 states that foretold a Kerry victory. And then Bush won in those states by that margin of victory. Now, whereas in Ukraine, we used the exit polls as the basis for supporting the dissident movement that challenged the incumbent, here, our official response was to say, oh, the exit polls diverged from the vote count. I guess we have to throw out the exit polls. Adjust them. They adjusted them. Well, I felt compelled, having written 2 books about Bush Cheney, as posing a dire and, I think, unprecedented threat to American democracy. I felt I ought to write a book about this, too. So I started to look into it. The evidence is copious. The evidence is overwhelming. It's not supposition. It's not conspiracy theory. All across the country, not just in Ohio, all across the country, the Bush machine did whatever it might take. They used a broad variety of tricks and tactics in order to do everything possible to cut the Kerry vote and pad the Bush vote. Now, this varies from state to state, but not all that much. In state after state, we know of 21 states where there were many, many complaints of the electronic touchscreen machines systematically flipping Kerry votes into Bush votes. It happened in Ohio, it happened in Tennessee, it happened in Kentucky, it happened in Wisconsin, it happened in Pennsylvania, it happened all over the place. Now, I've looked long and hard, and I've managed to find 4 claims that the touchscreen machines flipped Bush votes into Kerry votes. They're all in Texas. You know, I don't know if they're accurate or not. The machines are quite easy to, you know, mess with, so maybe it happened. But there's no statistical possibility that's going to happen. So many cases benefiting one party without there being some guidance from above. In state after state after state, not just Ohio, there was a systematic undersupply of voting machines to Democratic precincts. But there were long, long lines all over the country, only in Democratic areas. Now, these are just a couple of examples of the kinds of things that went on. And in state after state after state, the results were anomalous. They were surprising, in red states as well as blue. For example, in North Carolina, Bush was supposed to win by 6 points. He won by 15. Now, a number of people have examined the absentee ballots and the early balloting and found that the absentee ballots and the early balloting actually gave Bush 6% advantage. Only the machine count on election day gave him a 15-point advantage. So it happened in red states, and it happened in blue states. It happened in Wisconsin, where in 2000, Bush lost by 100,000 votes. 94,000 went to Nader, the others went to Gore. This time, Bush lost by only 12,000 votes in a blue state. You start to look into the things that went on in Milwaukee, in Madison, in Kenosha, in Racine. It was a veritable crusade to disenfranchise Bush's political opposition. So, you know, there's, as I say, copious evidence. Now, wrote the book, and it was my naive belief that having laid out this case with great care, it would be possible now to talk about the likelihood that the election was stolen in 2004, not with an eye toward removing Bush from office, because there's no constitutional way to do that. My primary purpose in writing the book was to jumpstart a national movement for election reform. Because if we don't deal with this problem, if we don't fix the election system so that it's trustworthy, trustworthy by all, if we cannot vote our representatives and our president in and out of office, we can make progress on no other front. This experiment is finished. This is the crucial issue. There is no other issue as important. In fact, it's not just an issue. It's the whole ballgame. As Tom Paine said, the freedom to vote is the very, you know, fulcrum on which all our other freedoms, the basis on which all our other freedoms stand. So, by coincidence, I got myself invited to another fundraiser for John Kerry in late October of 2005. The book came out a week later. Somebody very close to Kerry shares my concern about the integrity of the election system and got me invited to a fundraiser to give him the book, have a little FaceTime with him, and see if I could get him focused on it and so on. Because, you know, his concession, I believe, was a disaster, demoralized everybody, premature to say the least. And anyway, it's not about him. It's about the voters. Okay. There he was again. I had the book. I held it aloft. Get that shot. I said, "You were robbed, Senator." And he said, "I know." Just like that. "I know." And they started to complain about the fact that his fellow Democrats on the Hill won't discuss it with him. I couldn't believe it. They don't want to talk about it. He told me the week before he had a big argument with Chris Dodd of Connecticut, telling Dodd, "Look, these machines, there's all kinds of reasons why they're unreliable." He said Dodd just got mad. So we looked into this. There's no story there. Now, Kerry was staggered by this. But they were in denial. He said, "I need evidence to persuade these people." "Do you have evidence in your book?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." As I said to him, and as I've said elsewhere, there is copious evidence that they stole the election. There's actually no evidence that they won it. I mean, the official numbers, that's evidence that they won. But I challenge anyone to come up with any other evidence that they won. That's a lot of evidence to the contrary. And I pointed out to him the GAO report. How many of you have heard of the GAO report? Sure, don't feel bad because the press never reported this. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, is the research arm of Congress, bipartisan. I mean, we're not talking about the Comintern here. Okay, so I guess that's a rather dated joke. We're not talking about Pyongyang here. Oh, never mind. We're talking about a very establishment entity. Came out with a report in mid-October of 2005 giving detailed reasons why the voting machines aren't trustworthy. Now, these are machines that were then being and are still being shoehorned into state after state after state for us to conduct our elections. I said to Kerry, "There's the GAO report." He said, "Oh, the GAO came out with a report?" Which gave me pause. And I didn't say, what I wanted to say, which was, what is your staff in a coma? What I wanted to say. But I didn't say that. It would have been impolitic. I said, yes. And he was suitably impressed. So I said, look, in the spirit of your investigations of BCCI and Iran-Contra in the Senate, which I consider the high points of the Senate service, they were great investigations, I think that you should take this issue on. It's not just about your political career, although, you know, it will benefit you enormously because at the grassroots level, Democrats are really upset about this and angry about it. But it's also, you know, the American democracy can't survive unless there is an investigation. He was sympathetic, he was receptive. He said, that does have to be done, someone has to do it. I don't know if I'm the one to do it because of the sour grapes factor. I said, that's a problem. But I promise you, if you look at the evidence, you can say, you know, with perfect confidence that you were skeptical, but having studied the situation, you come reluctantly to the conclusion that there's something very wrong with that election for the good of the country, etc. I was writing a speech for him. So he said, oh, this is great, I'll read it, we'll talk. He socked me on the arm. He did. And he gave me a thumbs up. I felt special. I went out for a pass. You know. He didn't go that far. So I was, he went off to, you know, glad hand and raise money and so on, and I was exhilarated. Because here the party had been completely mum on this issue, and the man who had conceded hastily, conceded prematurely, the nominal head of the Democratic Party was saying to me, this was not on the record. This was, he didn't say just between us or anything like that. He was telling me, yeah, I think they stole it. And I think that my colleagues on the Hill are denying. So that was Friday, October 28th, the following Tuesday. I started to promote the book, and I took to telling this story at the events where I talked about the book because it had a galvanizing effect on people. I mean, sometimes the galvanized feeling was strongly tinged with anger, you know, by these days before. Still, it was, you know, far better. Whether it was angry or not, it was infinitely preferable to the sort of funk that everybody was in, and many people are still in the sense. There are more of them than us. They have outnumbered us. We are hopeless. We're helpless. We're eunuchs. We can't do anything. What can we do? But to hear that Kerry basically acknowledged the extreme likelihood of the death was to fuck people up. So that was on a week later, on the next Friday, I was on Goldman's Democracy Now!, told the story again. The producers got very excited and sent out a press release saying Kerry believed the race was stolen. And within hours, his office released a statement categorically denying he had the conversation with me.
Isn't that a classic?
Granting that I did give
him a book. Classic flip-flop.
But denying that we had the conversation. Now I was flabbergasted. And I was flabbergasted for this reason. Here was a guy who told me that he thinks the race was stolen, and he deplored the fact that his fellow Democrats in Washington are in denial on the subject. As soon as I told the story publicly, he immediately snapped into that same posture of denial. And I tell this story because I think it will help us to understand why the Democrats, and to some extent the press, have been almost completely silent on this issue. Democrats will not talk about this. Some of them actually give reasons why they will not talk about this. And the reasons are always patently absurd. For example, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, running for the Senate, completely progressive guy, highly intelligent, he says we really shouldn't talk about this issue. Because if we do, people might not come out to vote. How do you like that logic? Don't say anything, let them come out to vote. Okay, then the Republicans can throw those votes away. And then people will be even more depressed than they were in the first place. I ran into Jerry Nadler on the train coming back from one of the events on my tour. He's my congressman. Great guy. Progressive. He's on the House Judiciary Committee, the Conyers Committee. He helped work on the Conyers report, studying what happened in Ohio, so he knows what's going on. I said to him on the train, what's going on? This is November now. What's going on in Washington? What are you guys doing to try and fix the election system? He said, well, Bush won Ohio by what? 400,000 votes?
Oh.
That means he would have won anyway, despite the cheating. Now, Bush won Ohio 118,000 votes. That's considerably less than 400,000. I believe that Jerry Nadler came up with that inflated number out of a need for a rationale not to do anything. Because I think that the Democrats, by and large, are so frightened of the implications of what went down in 2004. It is so radically staggering that they just come up with a lot of reasons not really to admit that it happened. They are fundamentally in denial.
Consider this, though. That's exactly what happened with 9/11. People are so shattered to have to think about it. That they can't face it. And it's just exactly what's happened with the election. So, I mean, try to figure it out. I'm going to be the answer, too. The obstacle is that, you know what I mean? Because the right-wingers, they never want to face it. They're brainwashed. But they're in the minority. We won this election handily. In fact, if you read Robert Kennedy's Jr.'s new book, or the article, it was by a large margin that Kerry won. And that the electronic changes that went on are millions of votes. So the point is, we are in the majority, and they know it. And so it's this denial of our own party, so to speak, the Democrats and the progressives. The progressives doesn't talk
they
about
won't, they won't touch him. He's yeah. totally dissed. Al Franken won't have him on.
Yeah, they wish to break through to our outlets, our left-wing media, our Democrats have to know this.